We seem to have Microsoft dramatically outnumbered today. I don't know, it's been even like every other week. I don't know, maybe people just wanted to be, maybe there's a big party in Seattle at 9:30 and people just wanted to get here. I don't know. Yeah, just wanted to be here. So we have concurrency to finish up. We got to a pretty nice stopping point. Then we'll do course evals in the middle, and then we'll get to our last subject for the course, which is resource management, primarily focused on memory, because that's what everyone always focuses on, because it's kind of the most important resource, the one that comes up immediately in programming languages. Okay? So this was our outline slide from last time. Remember, we added concurrency, which was this very simple notion that instead of one active expression or one call stack, we had N of them, and we had shared memory. And so we learned how to control that as programmers via thread join or via locks. And then we said, well, let's forget about shared memory and let's just assume that we have multiple threads, but they communicate via message passing. And now on the homework, you're playing around with concurrent ML, which was a very principled, first-class, expressive way of doing that. And then I said, well, that's not really the order I wanted to present things in, but I wanted to make sure you had the weekend to do homework 5, because really, I wanted to talk about software transactions, which are very, very hot in the research community right now, and they're a shared memory thing. So we got to go back to that. Okay. So fundamentally, all atomic is, or atomicity, or software transactions, these are basically synonyms, is a synchronization primitive that is easier to use than locks and harder to implement than locks, which if you're a programming language user or a programming language researcher is a really good trade-off. So the idea, we were talking about bank account transfers last time, and so here's an example with locks. I probably showed code very, very similar to this, if not exactly like this. So maybe you want to do a transfer between two bank accounts. So you have a source account and a destination account and an amount you want to transfer. So maybe you've decided that your bank accounts will be represented with records that have a lock field and a balance field, and your invariant will be that you always acquire the lock field before you access the balance field. So you acquire both the locks, you do the transfer, and you release both the locks. And you go get a cup of coffee, and by the time you get back, you realize that your program is full of bugs. Because first of all, somewhere else in the code, people decided to access the balance field without acquiring the lock field. And if they do that, and you have kind of no way to stop them, then right here, they can see the wrong amount of money in the bank. And then you say, okay, well, we'll just shoot those people. And then you realize that the code you wrote is actually still wrong because it can deadlock. All you have to do is have one thread transfer from account 1 to account 2 at the same time that another thread is transferring from account 2 to account 1. Okay? So it's really hard to avoid this stuff, and there are absolutely ways to do it. But one way that just sort of makes it the language implementations problem says when you need synchronization control, why don't you use this function atomic that takes some computation to perform, performs it, and gives you back the answer. Well, that seems kind of like a waste of a function, and indeed in a single-threaded world, there's absolutely no reason to define this function. But in a multi-threaded world, we can add the additional promise from the implementer of Atomic that the system will behave as though there's no interleaving while this code is executed. Okay? And we'll add another promise, actually, of a certain fairness guarantee, which is basically that if this guy goes into an infinite loop, that the code executing this, the thread executing this, well, there's not much we can do. Stupid is as stupid does. But we'll at least let other threads continue. We won't cause all the other threads to starve just because this bad code decided to go consuming an arbitrary amount of time resources. Okay? So this is very exciting. There's a lot of people working on this, and I thought I'd just give you a couple perspectives on why people are so excited about this. So as I've just explained it, actually, is really the first reason. What are these atomic blocks good for? And I think they're good for software engineering. They make it harder to introduce races and deadlocks. Or let me flip that around. They make it easier to avoid races and deadlocks. It's just easier to program with. There is actually also a performance argument. So if you've ever read papers about optimistic concurrency protocols or things like that, the idea is that by getting rid of all the locks, which are very pessimistic, you're just kind of optimistically saying, gee, I really hope I can access all this data without anyone else needing it. And only if someone else does need it does the system need to do something fancy. Okay? And so this is basically making it easier to just say, gee, I hope this works, and bail me out if it doesn't. Okay? And depending how you feel about these, you'll feel very differently about the next two slides, where I give two slightly different definitions on what it actually means to be atomic. And I should also mention that when I said this was a really hot research area, it's actually really hot in the architecture community. So you could take a computer architecture class and they might talk about transactions. And it's really hot in the programming languages community. And this is a bit of the age-old argument of should we be, you know, implementing this feature in hardware or software or both. And it's not like an argument like we're mad at each other. We're legitimately trying to find out. And like everything, you know, there's pluses and minuses. Okay? And you may as well know that I'm like this in the, you know, to the extent I do research in this area, and it's about one-third of my research right now, I'm very squarely working on the software engineering side, and I'm not a computer architect. Okay? So I'm pretty biased about this stuff, but that's okay. All right? So so here's like two words you should know about atomicity, although since I'm in a charitable mood, I'll tell you neither of them are on the final. Which is these subtly different definitions on what exactly did I mean when I said there's no interleaving with, you know, in that atomic block. Let me flip back here. I said you're executing this code, and it has to behave like no one else is running at the same time. Well, the first thing I guess should emphasize is that's just the semantics, okay? We compiler writers play all sorts of games behind your back, so that, you know, code runs faster than you might naively think it would. So when we say it has to behave as though there's no interleaving, we don't actually mean we're going to stop everybody else. We just mean we're going to make sure that everybody else isn't accessing what you're accessing. Okay? And to the extent they do, we might have to slow them down or get them to wait. Okay? But that aside, that's the behave as if. What we really mean is no interleaved computation. So I have a picture here where the thin lines, this is one thread and this is another, and the thin lines are when you're running outside of an atomic block, and the big fat blocks are when you're running in an atomic block. Okay? So you're running along, one thread's running along, and it says, ooh, I want to do this without interleaving. It says, okay, when I'm done with that, I'll do this other stuff that other people can see, and then this has to appear to happen all at once, and so on. And similarly with this thread. And what I mean by no interleaving is your program has to behave as though the red blobs and the purple blobs don't have any interleaving from the other thread. But the green and the orange, well, that can interleave kind of arbitrarily. And we kind of talked last time just a little bit about what do you mean by arbitrarily, okay? And that is essentially the memory model question. What sort of order of the reads and the writes are other threads allowed to see? And it turns out the computer architects of the world have foisted upon us far weaker guarantees than you might reasonably assume. Okay? Like you might reasonably assume that if one thread writes to one location and then writes to another location, that another thread would never be able to see the second write but not see the first write. And it turns out most chips and most compilers do not make you that promise. But that's the orange versus green issue. Atomic just says you got to have all of this or none of this. Okay. So before a transaction commits, any writes, any mutations that the red blob did can't be visible to the other thread. And there's a reverse point which is also important. Any reads that it does has to be consistent. It can't be that it sees some reads from say here and some reads from here. Okay. And it's just that simple. There's this weaker notion, which if all you care about is building up these optimistic concurrency protocols is enough, but it's not nearly enough for preventing races. And that is this idea that the red blobs and the purple blobs can't ever be interleaved with each other, but we make no promises about the non-transactional code. Okay? So the red blob might interleave with some orange, and the purple blobs might interleave with some green. But we'll just say that's all atomic promise to you, and this is a much weaker definition. And one way to think about atomic versus locks is that weak atomicity is kind of between strong atomicity, because we didn't used to allow these, and locks, which is even weaker. If you think of these as acquire a lock, do some computation, release a lock, well then we're saying, well, you can be interleaved with purple blobs that acquire different locks. Make sense? All right. Okay, so this is me preaching, so I'm getting up, you know, to deliver a sermon now. Or that if atomicity is for software engineering, then you really need strong atomicity. Okay? And why? Because strong atomicity and not weak atomicity gives you three things. I think I'll skip this one, but let me focus on the other two. The first one is it lets you reason sequentially within a transaction. Okay, so you see an atomic and you see some code, and you can now look at that code and use all the sequential reasoning, sequential proof techniques, type systems, program verification, everything we've been learning for the last 9 weeks, and know that what you're thinking about is sound. You don't have to worry about the other threads in there. Whereas with weak atomicity, you have to say, well, as long as nobody outside of a transaction reads anything that I'm reading, then I can think of this in a non-concurrent way. Okay? And that's a pretty big caveat. The other thing I like a little more even is kind of a code maintenance or code evolution argument, which says you have some code and it's not in a transaction, and so you think, oh gosh, there might be races here, this might be the source of my bug, or I never really realized that someone might want to know how much money is in the bank, and if I, you know, have this split, they might get the wrong amount, so I'm going to put atomic around it. Okay? And if you do that in a strong atomic world, you're done. You now know that the code will behave as though there's no interleaving. And in a weak atomic world, you have this extra caveat that you have to go look at all the rest of the code in your system and make sure no one's accessing the same memory at the same time. And if that sounds familiar, that's exactly what you have to do with locks. And the whole point was to make concurrency easier. Okay? All right. So this sounds really great, and it sounds kind of like snake oil. Like I'm just going around telling you, oh, concurrent programming will be easy. It will never be easy. It's inherently harder than sequential programming, but I hope to make it easier. But let me be clear about some realities. The first one is that it's not going to solve everything. Just like we're going to talk about garbage collection for most of the day, it doesn't make memory management trivial, but it makes it a lot easier. So I really like this analogy, right? There are programs where garbage collection is terrible. There are programs where atomicity is terrible. But over time, more and more people tend to like the conveniences and the ease of use. There are things that you really, really can't do in atomic blocks. I guess last time or the time before, we were talking about the cowboy artist example. In the world of concurrency, we have the launch missiles example. Okay, there are always things that you just cannot do in atomic blocks, because as I'll show you, what implementations always do as they're going through an atomic block is they just kind of optimistically run it, and if they get to a point where they can't run it, they very often undo everything they've done. And so just as sort of a convenient turn of phrase, launching missiles is something you can't undo. It's kind of the example of sometimes you can't undo things. Okay. So what I thought I'd do is I just have one slide on how languages actually implement atomicity. It's just a really high-level view. In practice, there's a ton of very low-level, bit-level tricks. Oh, you lay out data in just a certain way and you use this very clever assembly language sequence. But the basic idea is very, very simple. And it involves everything in your program being compiled a certain way, but that's no problem. Compilers always assume that everything in your code is compiled a certain way. Okay? All right. So there's basically two ways to do it, and then you spend a lot of time working on the performance. So the first option is, as you run along in a transaction, before you read or write any mutable thread-shared data, acquire exclusive ownership of it. Say with a lock. But these are not locks that programmers control. These are locks controlled by the runtime system, and we can get it right once and for all by experts implementing the library. So as you go along in the transaction, you acquire ownership for everything you're touching. Now, this could trivially deadlock, right? You just have two transactions running at once. One acquires a bunch of ownership, the other acquires a bunch of ownership, and then this guy needs something this guy has, and this guy needs something this guy has. So we have the ability to detect that this has happened and roll somebody back. Undo anything that it has done, and now having rolled it back, we can continue the other guy. Rollback has the launch missiles problem, so we're careful to make sure we don't launch any missiles when we may have to roll back. And if you've taken an operating systems course, you may say, well, that might live lock. This is a lot like deadlock, except what happens is no one ever makes any progress. People just get rolled back forever. And that's true, but you use sort of conventional techniques like exponential back off, you know, waiting a while before you try running again and stuff. And people tend to feel that the live lock danger is okay. Okay? And as far as my own research, because I like to mention it when it comes up, if you were actually running on a uniprocessor, which there's a lot of them in the world, and they're going to be around, and they're going to be running multi-threaded code for a long time, you can do this really, really easily and really, really quickly.
What's a uniprocessor?
A uniprocessor is when you only have one thread actually running at a time. So you have multiple threads, and they can be preempted, like we were talking about last week, so they can get stopped at arbitrary points, but you don't actually have multiple running at the same time. Whereas a multiprocessor is, you know, the other situation where they're running in true parallel. Okay. All right. So there's a second version, a second way of thinking about it, and in practice we build hybrid systems all the time. And that way is, as you're running along in a transaction, don't change anything that anyone else can see. Do everything with a private version, so that if you have to get aborted, if you have viewed inconsistent things, because you went and read something from shared memory, you computed for a while, some other transaction changed some things in shared memory, and then you read something there, and that's going to break atomicity. That doesn't work. Well, then the rollback is trivial. You just throw away everything you've done, and you go back to where you were. Okay, so that makes the rollback much, much easier. It makes the commit, the I'm actually at the end of my transaction, much, much harder. Because now you have to take all that local stuff. Rod, feel free to come here and restart things. Oh, no, I'm okay. Never mind. Huh. It said I crashed, but I didn't. Okay. Okay, so we had our... Now we have all this private stuff, and we have to get it back into the shared world. Okay, we can't stop everybody. Maybe we can, but that would be inefficient. We need to get everything back, all the changes we made, to the shared view. Now, we know we're done. We know we have the right answers. But the reason why it's fancy is if you have multiple threads trying to reflect changes back at the same time. And they tend to use very fancy algorithms to avoid any nastiness there. Yeah?
Is there a way, are there any proposals which would expose rollback to the source? So you could have, it's sort of like a finally or something, but...
Yeah, let me say two things about that. First of all, we tend to always provide an explicit abort, okay, that says, I got to this point in my atomic block, and I don't have what I need, right? So I'm trying to read something out of a shared queue, and the queue is empty. Very simple idioms like that. You say, try me again later. Undo anything I've done so far, and try me again later, okay? Now, so that's an explicit abort that programmers can write down. They literally write A-B-O-R-T. But that is still, the atomic block will still execute later. So atomic still has what people call exactly once semantics. Okay, the atomic block will successfully complete once, or I guess zero times, but you will not get past it. If it successfully completes zero times, you will not get past it. A different idea that has nothing to do with concurrency is to have rollback not for the purpose of synchronization control, but for the purpose of exception handling. Okay? So what if you had a different kind of exception that said, if I throw this exception and it's caught in some, you know, by some new kind of try, let's call it try prime, then anything I did between when I installed the try prime and when I caught the exception gets undone. Okay? And actually, that was implemented at Microsoft Research in the very building where you're sitting by David Tarditi and a couple of his colleagues. It's good for certain programming idioms. It's terrible for others. And that's why I was very careful to call it try prime. And they agree with me. This is you should not change your definition of try to do this because it changes the meaning of programs. But I can certainly see where it has uses. Other questions or comments?
Okay. Well, I do have a question. Do you have any reference to one of those fancy algorithms?
So what started it all was a paper by Tim Harris and Keir Frazier. Harris is now at MSR Cambridge, but he was at Cambridge University at the time. And this was in UPSLA, Object-Oriented Programming Systems, Languages and Applications, 04 or 03? I think 04.
Okay.
It's called Lightweight Support for Language Transactions. It's an excellent paper, really motivates all the language stuff. When they get to the fancy protocol, it's fancy. But you'll enjoy it. And then next month at PLDI, the Premier Programming Languages Conference, there are not one, not two, but three papers on atomicity. One of them is by a computer architecture group, so they have a hardware simulator. They're actually proposing a new chip that provides hardware support. And the other two are by software groups, one at Intel, one at Microsoft. Okay. All right. So I guess the one thing I wanted to leave you with is that the implementation of atomicity is not magic. There is still locking going on. There is still synchronization control. But basically, it's now in the compiler and the runtime. You just say what you need to execute without interleavings, and it's the runtime's job to figure out what you're accessing and in what order and what other people are accessing at the same time. And the nice thing about language implementation solutions, and this is a fantastic lead-in to garbage collection, is they can be as complicated as you want. But that complexity scales with large programs because it doesn't matter how big your program is. Okay? The difficulty of writing a garbage collector does not depend on the size of the program. Whereas when you're using malloc and free, most people would agree that the complexity of avoiding dangling pointer dereferences depends a lot on how big your program gets. On the flip side, as someone who writes compilers and runtime systems can tell you, I have no idea what your program's trying to do. And that can mean that the one-size-fits-all solution I'm trying to implement may not actually fit, may lead to bad performance, may just be a bad match for your application. So that's why I kind of like to call these runtime services sort of one-size-fits-most. And if you don't like these services, if you think they do a bad job, then you call them like one-size-fits-few. But it's, you know, it's a continuum, and the truth of the matter is somewhere along it. Okay? Questions there. Yeah.
I've never quite understood what you'd do if you were writing a method that you knew was going to take a while.
Mm-hmm.
Normally you're protected by locks, we're just going to stop everything else in the program. But you know it's long running, so it's not going to interact well with the other atomic blocks. So what would you do?
If you knew you had a long running transaction, you knew you couldn't break it up.
Would you have to add locks to everywhere else in your program to make that work?
No, I mean you will. Okay, so the long-running transaction will eventually get to complete, but it may have to wait a while. You know, just like, there's basically a fair scheduling guarantee going on.
Okay.
So it says if you're trying to do something that's going to take you a long time, you're going to have to wait your turn.
Okay.
So if you're going to do something that's going to take n time slices, you might have to go to sleep for time n first, and then we'll give you that much time. And the systems let you talk to the scheduler like that a little bit. Yeah.
Just because it's long running doesn't mean that there'll be contention, though, right?
That's right.
You might be accessing separate data. Then
that's right.
The problem with being long running.
That's right. And in fact, the reason why people love transactions is the idea is that so most of the time your hash table is running along and you just can have lots of parallel access, right? Inserts and lookups at the same time, but hopefully to disjoint buckets. Everything's working great. And then someone comes along and says, it's time to resize the table. And resizing the table in the presence of parallelism is really, really complicated. But you know what? Doesn't happen very often, so we can probably live with blocking everybody out for a while, doing the resize, letting everybody else back in. And it's very easy to code up with atomic as a result. Okay. All right. So I was asked, and it's a reasonable question, can we do course evaluations at the end? I'm always a jerk about it. It's not you guys. I'm always a jerk. I always do them usually at the beginning, but I wanted to get atomic out of the way first. Because otherwise, everyone's in a rush. They fill out the form as quickly as possible, and I don't get any decent feedback. So that's why I never do them at the end. So we'll take 20 minutes once I get through the stuff I have to say about it. Then we'll talk about memory management. I have like two slides just reminding you everything we did in the course. Of course, we have the final next Tuesday. And if we have extra time, I'm happy to stick around with questions. But now is the course evaluations part. And Kevin, so that's course evaluations. Thank you very much. They're always important and read over carefully. And now we get to talk about memory management, which is a fun topic, I think. And I do this a little more strangely than a lot of people, I suppose. Some people love to just jump right into how does garbage collection work. And we will do that. I'll keep it kind of to the basics, although I'll show you cool tricks where they come up, because they are cool. But I think that it's really, really important to focus on the problem, and so we'll do that first, and we'll talk about why you need memory management, and what does it mean to have safe memory management, and we'll talk about issues like drag, which is just something with a technical definition that's very important when you start thinking about, oh, I need to reuse my memory, well, when should you reuse it, things like that. And then I'll tell you how this magic thing called garbage collectors work, and if anything, they're less magical than atomicity. And then I'll point out that garbage collection is not the only way to have safe memory management. I hear people say this all the time, so it's kind of like my moral duty to say, no, it is one way, it is probably the most convenient way to have safe memory management. But if you're willing to take things away from programmers, and we are, we spent 30% of the class taking things away from programmers, then there are other things you can do and other idioms you can enforce. Okay? All right. So, this is just framing the problem, so I'm not, you know, I think sort to a large extent telling you things you already know, but as often, you know, it introduces vocabulary and it sort of frames what we're trying to do, right? So the first thing is everything in our program takes up space. All those values, all the objects we made, every time you call 3, 4 in camel, it goes and makes a pointer. Of course, the compiler can optimize a lot of this away to some new object that holds a 3 and a 4. And in fact, as we'll see when we get to garbage collection, it's got another word too that says, I hold a pair of integers, basically. Okay. And it may be more obvious in other languages exactly when you're doing this, but the point is this all takes up space. And if you're in a world that where you're worried about code showing up at runtime or you're creating code that you might not need later, you start worrying about code taking up space as well. We can stick in the simpler world where we imagine that before the program started running, it had a pile of code, and we can just keep all that code around until the program's done. So in that world, you don't have to worry about code. Okay? So if you use too much space, you create too many of these objects, and when you talk about memory management, you call these things objects, not to be confused with the things from object-oriented programming. We basically just mean anything you might point to. Your program runs slower. It runs slower because to find room to hold all this, the computer has to go to areas of memory that take longer to access, and you lose cache effects and things like that, whereas if you really only use things that are right next to each other, the hardware actually gets it to run even faster than you might expect. Okay? And you know, you can talk about slowing down programs, eventually they just stop running. Right? Eventually you literally run out of memory. Or you run out of RAM, and by the time you're going to the disk, you may as well stop. Or you're not actually running on a desktop computer, you're running in some space where you just don't have that much memory. Okay? So, if that's the problem, we don't want to use too much space, what would the optimal solution be? The optimal solution would be, as soon as you use an object for the last time, reclaim the space it occupies, and use it again later. Okay, there's fragmentation issues and stuff we can talk about later, but basically the idea is as soon as you're done with an object, reclaim it. And as far as what's correct and what's not, if you reclaim it any earlier, your program is wrong. Right? By reclaim, I mean it can be used for something else, and if you still need it to hold the old thing, you still need to hold it a three, and now it holds a pointer, your program is just wrong. And this is usually called a dangling pointer dereference, because you pointed to the object, then the object was reclaimed, so you're no longer pointing to that object. That's a dangling pointer. And when you then used the object, i.e. followed the pointer, or dereferenced the pointer, you have a dangling pointer dereference. Okay? So you can't go earlier. To the extent you go later, that's this funny word called drag. It's a drag on your program. It's dragging you down. It's like the airplane drag, right? Like it's a cost that you're paying. It slows you down. And drag for an object is literally the time between its last use and when you actually reclaim the space. Okay? That's all there is, just the definition. Okay? So, having framed that discussion, I would argue that optimal is trivially undecidable. Go ahead, Matt. Yep.
Drag doesn't take into account the size of the allocation?
No. I mean, it's just as a definition, every allocated object has a drag time. Here, I should actually show this picture. This is sometimes called the object lifetime picture. Time moves to the right, and you're born, right? And then you have your last use. Then you have drag time, and then you're reclaimed. That's kind of all there is to it. So, determining an object's last use is undecidable because we don't know what the program is going to do in the future, right? So, you know, we have some if, and there's some arbitrary expression there, and then we have then, and we use x, say, continuing with my pair example, first of x, else 37, and if we have some use of x here, we need to know right now, if we're going to be optimal, whether to reclaim the object or not, and that would require looking into the future and knowing how it's going to be evaluated. So we know we can't do optimally, and we know that we can't even do as well as humans, who can always outpace any sort of automatic analysis on what's going to be needed when. Okay? Second caveat, and not only are we not going to do optimal, we may not want to do optimal. Okay? So let's say we have 100 dinky little, tiny little objects. And we tried really hard to reclaim all that space right away, right away, right away, right away. It probably would have been a lot faster if there was some way to just group them all. Say make one object that was 100 times as big, wait till we were done with all 100, and then reclaim the object all at once. Right? And this is just a classic space-time trade-off. You might be willing to waste a little bit of space in the short run in order to make your reclamation process faster later. And that's a very difficult trade-off, but that's okay. Okay? Questions? All right. So what does all this look like from the C or C++ world, where we can talk about things like we have stack objects. Okay, so those are the things that are created. Those are the local variables. Okay, so I might have something like int x or maybe even some unboxed class object y, and so on. Okay? And those really do take up space. Don't think that they don't. But they take up space on the stack, which we tend to draw as a big vertical rectangle, divided into a separate frame for each call. My stacks grow down. And so the shallowest call, when I call f, will make a little room for x and a little room for y, and so on. Okay, and those absolutely take up space, but they're reclaimed automatically. See, don't let anyone ever tell you that C doesn't have automatic memory management. Automatically, when we hit the corresponding close brace, right? Those are your stack objects. Then you have this other thing, the heap, typically drawn as a big cloudy blob. Okay, and when, if you want to put something in there, you call malloc or new, and you get a pointer to some new space. And that space exists until the programmer calls free or delete. Okay? You can create dangling pointers either into the stack or into the heap. Into the heap by calling free, into the stack by returning the address of a local variable, which most compilers will warn you about, but it's easy to fool the compiler. Just pass the address of x down to a callee, get the callee to return it back, you return it too. And I can, you know, if that doesn't work, just try a little bit harder. It's very easy to get around the compiler warnings. Okay? So it's very easy to create dangling pointer dereferences, which again is just a pointer to space that's been reclaimed. That can be a pointer into the stack or into the heap. And the thing I cannot emphasize enough is that dangling pointers are perfectly okay. Dereferencing them is not. Okay? So most people, and don't get me wrong, you know, every time you yell at one of your team members for creating a dangling pointer reference, I'm not telling you that was the wrong thing to do. As a programming idiom, they're probably a really bad idea. But from the perspective of safe memory management, there's absolutely nothing wrong with them. It's following them. Yeah.
Just as you're talking about C++, there's nothing in the C++ standard that says that dangling pointer is fine. That's why architectures will crash.
Interesting. Okay, I take it back. The language standard disallows it. Well, what do you?
It doesn't disallow it. It's just not defined what's going to happen if you have a dangling pointer and you do anything with it. Arithmetic. Sometimes arithmetic will actually dereference in the hardware.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. I'm not allowing any uses. Yeah, because I have to. Because the point is, you know, after I say delete p, p is a dangling pointer.
Yes.
It's still in scope. I have it on my stack. It exists. Yeah. But we do have to, right. I said dereferencing P is unsafe. It turns out calling delete on it again is definitely unsafe. And I perfectly allow that the language standard also says that adding one to it is unsafe. That's totally fine. Yeah. But having it there, and I bet they allow you to pass it to a callee without touching it, right? Just calling F with P or, you know, putting it in a hash table. You know, we always have this distinction, the whole class, between like using something and passing it around. And I bet you're allowed to pass it around. Yeah, but believe me, I haven't read this. I've read the C standard, believe it or not, but not the C++ standard. All right, cool. All right. And in the C++ world, this is where we get to define a space leak. An unreclaimed object that becomes unreachable. And we're going to define reachability on the next slide, but you may have an intuitive notion, will never be used. It can't be used. There's no way to reach it. It will never be reclaimed. It can't be. There's no way to reclaim it. So in terms of our definition of drag, that object will be around until the program terminates. I drew that timeline. It'll be there till the program terminates. This is often what people call a space leak. Yeah.
What does unsafe mean?
It basically means a dangling pointer dereference. that's basically what it means. It means that, yeah, for the purpose of memory management, that's basically what it means. I would add another thing that people often don't emphasize. I would argue that if you call malloc or new, or you create new local variables, those should be unaliased. Okay? If malloc is returning a pointer to space that someone else can also get to, I would argue that is not safe memory management. Because the whole reason I'm calling malloc is I need some new space. Don't give me something that somebody's already using. Yeah.
Social engineering through software. There was a program that had run fine for just years on one version of Unix, and then they ported it to Linux. And Linux decided that when you tried to return a piece of local memory off the stack, but they were going to overwrite it so that your program would break sooner rather than later.
Uh-huh.
It was an entire new software cycle for them to fix that. The bug had been there for years.
Yeah. I can tell more recent examples not to do with memory management. GCC3 got much pickier about casting one function pointer type to another. I've often written compilers that generate C code, and I was playing function pointer cast games that should be perfectly fine. But are not. It turns out in C and C++, you can't. It's totally fine if you have a function that takes a void star. This is totally sanctioned to pass it an int star. Okay, it's basically subtyping, although they won't call it that. It is not okay to take a function pointer type that takes a void star and say, "Oh, I can take an int star." That is because the standard wants to allow coercive subtyping. You would never expect that in a C compiler. I've never seen a C compiler actually do it. I know of a couple exceptions, but they want to support it. And GCC started basically giving earlier errors than they used to. And I was doing casts I wasn't quite supposed to do.
GCC is a strong argument against open source software.
I'm not going to say that. I use it all the time, but yeah.
Well, I do too.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so we have this note. This is the notion of space leak that people who program in languages with manual memory management are very used to, and I'm going to. And it's a good definition to know, and I will try to stick with that, but I do want to convince you. I'm happy to call this a space leak, but I am going to convince you that there are other space leaks that aren't called that, including leaks in garbage collected languages. Okay? They're just not called space leak spelled this way or something. Okay? So we do have to talk about reachability, and as usual in a class like P505, we're not going to leave it at the informal notion. And it turns out that our old friend recursive definitions work just fine here. Okay? So here's an inductive definition of reachability. It basically amounts to the transitive points to relation. Basically, we assume we have some notion of global variables. If you're in a language like Java, you can say static fields are global variables. And those are always reachable. And we claim that stack objects that have not been reclaimed, and I already defined reclamation of a stack object, it was when you hit that closing curly brace, are reachable. Okay? And then we say everything pointed to by a reachable object is reachable. But that's the recursive one, right? That goes arbitrary levels into your heap. So you start with your stack and your globals, and those are all reachable. And then you have your big heap blob, and whatever any of these point to is reachable, but then anything they point to is reachable, and so on. And this definition will terminate because there's only a finite amount of memory, and so you can't, you know, so maybe everything's reachable, but probably there are some things that are not.
And when you say global variables, you really mean global values, right?
Yeah, I mean the contents of
if you have a global variable that's a pointer, you mm-hmm. just like give it a new value. And it's still a global variable, but that pointer is gone.
Yes, and I would say the variable, the location where that pointer is held, is what's always reachable. And then I have this rule, that whatever is it, whatever it points to, is also reachable. Okay. I should say, as I explained it here, real compilers do a little bit better on your stack variables. They do a little bit of static analysis to say, well, I know where the program counter is, I know where you are in the function, and I know that you're not going to use certain local variables again, and therefore I know that they are not going to be used. Okay? I thought I introduced this word here. I guess I waited till I got to the actual garbage collection stuff. This is just a word. These things are called roots. Okay? Roots as in the bottom of a tree. Okay? What's that? Yeah.
Question. Yeah. So in a language like C, you can kind of go trolling.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to use pointers because, you know, you can blow past the stack, you can do, you know, go past the end of your string or array, and just kind of look for stuff.
It doesn't quite
seem to be in your reachability definition.
That's right. And the language actually disallows all this, but they make it an implementation-dependent operation. I actually have a slide about that for how C gets garbage collected and how they have to technically ban all this. Even though I totally guarantee it works. But yeah. Yep. Yeah, and this is, there's kind of nothing more to say. In some sense, if you can take an arbitrary integer, cast it to a pointer, and see what's at that address, then everything is reachable. Yeah. And so, therefore, ever calling free would always be a dangling pointer or something, but that's just, you know, not the definition. Yep.
There's all kinds of badness that you can get if you do that. Even if you wrap it in a try-catch. Because stack expansion on Windows is triggered by guard page reads. So you get an exception, and then the stack grows, and then when you hit it again, you lose because it doesn't reset, because you haven't really grown the stack. You may not be growing the right stack, you might be growing the wrong stack.
Yeah, you definitely don't want it. I mean, there's definitely none. And it turns out I have read the C standard. Like, none of this is sanctioned. I mean, we all have this. If you have this intuitive notion of how you expect the C code to be compiled, then you expect it to work. But it's not supposed to, or it doesn't have to. Yeah. And that's important for these sort of definitions. And I do have a slide on basically how to garbage collect C, and it has to ban these things. I should put up there is a classic paper from the mid-80s, late 80s, on exactly what you have to assume about your C code for garbage collection to work. It's things like, you know, you can't write a pointer to disk and then read it back in later. It's important, but you shouldn't be doing that. Okay. So in this world of reachability and C, the name of the game is the way you avoid a space leak, as defined on the previous slide, is you call free before the object becomes unreachable. Okay? Unreachable means not reachable. Because if you wait till it's unreachable, you cannot call free on it. But, and this is the key distinction, and this is the sort of change mindset when you go to a garbage collected language, in the garbage collected language, your entire goal, if you're a space-conscious programmer, is to make things unreachable. because that's when they get collected. Okay? So in C, you're trying to not make them unreachable because then their drag time will be infinite. And in a garbage collected language, you're trying to make them unreachable because that's how you call free on them. Okay? That's all there is to it. All right. So, very important point. Since garbage collected languages, by definition, reclaim unreachable objects, which, by the way, means reachability has to be part of your language definition or programmers can't have a space guarantee, then by our strict definition of space leak, leaks are impossible. Because as soon as you create what should be a leak, the garbage collector comes and rescues you. But a more sort of pragmatic definition of leak is an infinite drag time. Right? You're done with it, you're never going to use it again, and yet you're not reusing that space. Okay? And that can absolutely happen in a garbage collected language because there's a huge difference between reachability and last use. Right? One implies the other in this way. If it's not reachable, it won't be used again. But it's not an if and only if. Maybe it's reachable and it won't be used again. Right? So if you want your Java program to run out of memory and throw an out-of-memory exception or whatever it's called, I think that's right, just create a static field, give it a list type, keep putting longer and longer things in that list, and watch it die. Okay? Don't ever use the list. Right? It'll be there forever. You're never using any of that stuff in the list. And it's fair to say, but you're using that global variable, that's reachable. Yeah, but you're not using all the stuff it points to. Right? You created a really long list, and all this stuff is dead in some sense. It's not going to be used again, but it's reachable. Okay? So what do you do if you're programming a garbage collected language? How do you deal with this issue that everything reachable is kept around, but not everything reachable should be kept around? Well, what you typically do is you ignore it. As far as social engineering, it just seems to work. This just doesn't seem to happen so much. Okay? But it does. It does come up. And what space-conscious programmers do is they try to be really careful, and like when they're done with this global variable, they go and write null into it. Okay? Hoping that that makes all this stuff unreachable. If they're wrong, if there's some other alias into it, then okay, the stuff will be kept around, but that maybe that's a good thing because maybe the data wasn't actually dead. Okay? So, is this automatic memory management? Is this safe? Well, kind of. I mean, it's definitely not going to seg fault. You're definitely not going to go trolling for memory. You're definitely, the program is getting exactly what he or she asked for. But it is kind of manual memory management. I mean, what if the programmer was wrong and someone did need that global variable? Well, they're going to get a null pointer exception, or they're going to think that the list was empty when it wasn't actually empty from an application logic level. Okay? So it's error prone, but this is absolutely something I think the programmer should know about. It's the way you communicate with the memory manager and tell it that you're done with something.
Yes. So what you're saying, if the programmer sets that to null and someone else will use it later, but if someone else is going to use it later, then they have a way to point to it, right?
Oh, only if this is a global variable like x, maybe they're just assuming, okay, I'm going to use x later.
Okay.
Right? That is their way. Yeah.
Okay, sure. And it would be null.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There is another thing you should know about if you ever need something like it, which is called a weak pointer. This has to be provided as a language feature. A weak pointer is a very simple idea. It is a pointer that does not count for reachability. Okay? So it works. It's a pointer. It points to an object. You can follow it, but it doesn't count for reachability. Now, is this a backdoor? No. What happens is following it can raise an exception. So it's a checked exception. And so the garbage collector and the language and everything has to keep track of, for all these pointers, there basically has to be an extra bit, a 0 or a 1 over here, that says, is this pointer still legit or not? Okay. And so if the garbage collector runs, decides the pointed to object is otherwise unreachable, i.e. this is the only pointer to it, then it will deallocate the object, turn this bit into a 1, and the next time you try to follow this pointer, it won't work. You'll get an exception. Okay. This is very useful, for example, I want to keep a big hash table of objects around, but if I do that, nothing's ever going to become unreachable. So use a weak table, and that gets you the best of both worlds. You should know, by the way, and I'm not going to get into this with the details of garbage collection, weak pointers slow down garbage collection. They're pretty nasty to deal with. They're in languages because they're useful, but if you ever talk to someone who implements garbage collectors, and correct me if you know someone, you know, they'll probably have a choice word or two about weak pointers. Keeps them busy. Okay? Questions? All right. So that is the problem. And again, I know it's, you know, for many of you, it's stuff you live and die by every day. But I think it's important to get the problem right so that when I show you how garbage collection works, we know why it's right or what our options are. Okay? Okay. So, here's how a garbage collector works. Find all the reachable objects and reclaim all the other ones. Okay? That's it. The rest is in the details. Okay? So how do you find them all? Well, you start at the roots. I knew that word was on the slide somewhere. Okay? You follow all the pointers, but don't just follow all pointers. Follow all pointers to objects you haven't seen before, which is a fancy way of saying don't go around cycles. Okay? Because if this finding everything reachable could go around cycles, then garbage collection would take an infinite amount of time. And that's no fun for anybody. Okay? So all we have to do to get this sketch to work is, given a root, something on our stack maybe, or a pointed to object, we need to be able to find all the pointers in that object to continue the reachability, right? And we need to know how big the object is, not only so we can find all the pointers, but so if we do find an unreachable one, we know how much space, because it's very convenient to draw these blobs with rectangles in them, but you know, in reality, we just have a big address space. Reality, if you're a software person. If you're a hardware person, this is still just a major illusion. But you know, we say, oh, you know, well, nobody's pointing to here, and we need to know where the end of the object is, because maybe somebody is pointing to here. Things like that. So we got to know how big objects are. We need to be able to find all the pointers. We'll assume that everything that's not a pointer is an integer, so that's kind of the same as this guy. We need to avoid cycles so that our reachability stops. Okay, so I'll do this first because it's fairly generic. But when we get into the avoiding cycles, it depends pretty fundamentally on how exactly the garbage collection is going. So I have to give multiple answers to this, and it depends on some other things. Okay. Oh, big thing I forgot. I kind of said this at the beginning before we did course evals. Everything we're doing for memory management could be done for open network connections or open files or any other finite resource, right? Turns out we don't tend to garbage collect open files, all right? It turns out that in a language like Java, and I'm pretty sure C# is the same, if you close a file and then try to read from it, you get an exception. That's manual memory management. The close is free, and the read is the reference. And it's just felt that programmers can get it right for files, and they can't get it right for memory. Okay, and that's probably reasonable, because memory is more interesting. You can build arbitrary data structures. You don't tend to build, you know, file handles that point to other file handles and stuff. But you know, memory management is just one resource management problem. And reachability is something that works for any resource management problem. It's just more appropriate for some than others. Yeah.
Do you think using like automatic resource management for only some classes of resources and not others makes life more difficult? I mean, like, people complain all the time about, you know, finalizers and trying to figure out how you're supposed to
Yeah, I mean,
we'd be in a better place. Like, could we just say, okay, all resources are managed by the garbage collector?
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly do it. I mean, so, I mean, I think the only reason sort of file handles aren't implicitly closed by the language when they become unreachable is this feeling that, well, there aren't very many of them and their structure tends to be pretty regular. And as you get into more complicated settings where that sort of assumption breaks down, it seems more, you know, it breaks down. Yeah.
Could part of the reason we don't manage files be the drag that you want them closed right then and there?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right too. Especially if you have a file system semantics where you better close it before somebody else opens it. You know, if you're confusing sort of flushing from closing, you know, stuff like that, which can be a good, I mean, there may be very good reasons in your file system to have that confusion. I don't mean that as a criticism. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, C Sharp has like little things like using, which is kind of like, well, I'm going to create this little space and I want you to garbage collect my files or any objects that I create in this space.
Right. You know, that's very similar. One of the things I hope to get to is region-based memory management, and that's very similar to that, actually. So there is an analogy in the memory space where you could do the same thing. You could say, using, create a bunch of memory, and when I hit the end, say, that's it, I don't want any of that memory. Now, the tough question is, what if some object has escaped? That's the you know, stored in a global variable, something like that. You know, if you take one of those file handles in the using, you put it in a global, well, I guess it's just going to be closed, but if someone else tries to, there's still a way to get a,
you can still dereference it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another hand.
My question is, what if you have enough memory and the program is small enough that garbage collecting would seem like it would be a waste?
So you just don't need it? Just don't ever deallocate anything?
Yeah, does the garbage collector support that type of scenario, or how would it know?
So the scenario where you just have enough memory, and there's just, so typically garbage collectors don't run until they need to, but need to is somewhat in the eye of the beholder. Turns out you don't really want to go until your RAM is full. Turns out you would like to run in smaller amount of space. There's all sorts of architectural reasons why you'll run faster. So there's tough trade-offs of how hard should the garbage collector work to get you into a smaller space, or should it just accept that, you know, a little more space is fine? And garbage collectors try to dynamically adapt. It turns out a lot of systems also have compile time or even runtime flags to tell the garbage collector what you want. And people will run servers running things in garbage collected languages to tweak these flags all the time. Cool. All right. So let's see. Those were great questions. But remember, these are the problems we're trying to solve. If we're going to do reachability, we have to be able to figure out how big an object is, and within that object, which fields hold pointers to other objects. Okay? So we got to be able to do that. So I want to show you that that's not very magical. And I also want to point out in passing that when you call free on some pointer, it has to know the object's size too. So don't think this having to know the size is a new burden on garbage collected languages. It's an old burden. It has to be provided by malloc and free. The knowing which fields are pointers, that's a new thing. Okay. So the simplest solution is every time you allocate an object, you return to the programmer pointer to some new space with the fields that he or she thinks are there and a secret field before it. So it's typically called the header word, and it has in it the size. It says, I'm 16 bytes long, assuming that each of these is 4. Okay? So what you actually did is you consume 20 bytes, assuming this guy's also 4, and this guy has a 16 in it, so that when the garbage collector comes along, it can figure out, given this pointer, where the end of the object is. Okay? Middle pointers are much more complicated. All sorts of tricks are pulled to be able to get from the middle of the object back to the beginning. Okay. If that sounds expensive, it turns out in an object-oriented language, you have already paid that cost. Okay. If you remember, when we were implementing object-oriented languages, at least in PowerPoint, we said there's an extra field that points to the code for the methods. Okay. Well, guess what? Every time you call new C, you get an object of the same size, typically. So we don't put the 16 in the header word. What we do is the header word is just the pointer to that other guy that has all the methods, the pointer to all the code, and the 16 in it. And that 16 is not the size of this guy, it's the size of this guy. Okay? And it just saves space that way. Okay, so the size of the object is really not a big deal. It is a cost, and so typically in languages, when you call malloc, you're actually allocating more space than you think you are, because there's the metadata, the data that the runtime system, the memory manager, needs to keep track of where you are. Okay, there are ways to avoid this. They're not so important, but you should know it's avoidable and that people have thought of it. So for example, you could use size segregation. You could say, everything in this huge area of my address space is 20 bytes long and is 20 byte aligned. So I know exactly where the objects end in this big space. And if you want an object that isn't 20 bytes long, put it somewhere else. Okay? And then the runtime system can just take the address of the pointer, say, ah, you're in my 20 byte space, and it's done. And that saves space for the metadata. Okay? This is often called bebop, for big bag of pages. I don't know why. I have to ask someone who invented the term. Okay? Okay. The point is really that the compiler often fills in these size fields. And so it turns out the compiler, the code generator, is really collaborating with the garbage collector, the memory manager, more than people think. In C, that's not true. Malloc is actually the one writing the 16 in there. But no big deal. You got to have the size somewhere. Okay? So far, so good. Now we got to find all the pointers. Okay? So we know the size. We know... Whoa. We know we got a 16 here, so we got four guys. Okay? Now we got to know which of these hold pointers. That's brutally important, because if there's a pointer there, we got to reclaim, i.e. declare reachable, whatever it points to. But if it's not a pointer, like it's 497, we better not treat it as a pointer. Right? Because there might not be anything there, and we probably shouldn't go reading 497. So there's this huge distinction in garbage collectors between garbage collectors that know what's a pointer and what's not, and those that don't. So if a garbage collector can tell for every object in memory where all the pointers are exactly, it's called an accurate garbage collector. That's just a term. And if it doesn't, it's called a conservative garbage collector. Okay? So there are, it is possible to write conservative garbage collectors, and what basically happens is for all four of these fields, the garbage collector says, maybe it's an int, and maybe it's a pointer. So what does it do when it hits 497? Well, what it actually does is it figures out, I never allocated an object at address 497. It must be an int, and it doesn't follow it. On the other hand, maybe there's some int that actually does happen to hold the same numeric value as an object that was allocated. In which case, the garbage collector conservatively assumes that the object is reachable. And in theory, this is a huge problem, because let's say you have this enormous data structure. It's like the world's biggest binary tree. It's enormous, megabytes. And you're done with it. It's totally unreachable. But its root happens to be at address A, and there happens to be some integer that holds A. A conservative garbage collector will say, ah, I guess that better be reachable. And if the root is reachable, everything is reachable. And you end up holding on to this enormous object that should have been garbage collected. Okay? In practice, this really seems to work just fine. Okay? But it's something you do have to be aware of, and it's a primary argument against conservative garbage collection. Yeah?
So to what degree does that go to? Is it only pure objects? Or because like, what happens if a jump register had that value in it?
Yeah. That goes to the question of what's a root. Okay, now I explain roots as global variables and stack pointers. There's registers. Those have to be roots, too. And that's a big deal, actually. But it's not too hard. When the garbage collector gets called, it's easy for it to run through the registers. If it has any knowledge from the compiler about where data pointers can and cannot be, then it's fine. Another thing I was kind of skipping over is I made it sound easy to find all the roots. Turns out crawling up the stack is no easy task, and is often done in collaboration with the compiler as well. Yeah.
How do we find registers that belong to threads which are system threads and which are not running?
Okay, I got one slide on multi-threads and garbage collection in like toward the end. I'm totally assuming single-threaded here. The simple version is before you garbage collect, you quote-unquote stop the world. The problem is that doesn't scale. If you have more than, say, like 8 processors, you spend all your time stopping the world and restarting it, no time doing any interesting computation. Okay. All right. So in the conservative world, we don't know what's a pointer and what's an integer, so we just have to be conservative and assume that anything might be a pointer. And might be an integer. We just have to, you know, be cautious as we go along. In the accurate world, someone has to tell us. We can't look. You cannot look at 32 bits and go, oh, it's a pointer. Right? Someone has to tell you. Okay. And one way to tell you is that class pointer from the previous slide that told us the size of the object can also tell us where the pointers are. Because again, it's shared for all the objects of that class. So that class pointer for new C says at offsets 8 and 12 are pointers and everything else is an int. Okay? And it tends to be represented pretty compactly as just a bit vector. All right, you know, one, you know, a one is a, it's a pointer in that field, and a zero it's an integer. That's kind of all there is to it. That's not how CAML works. CAML doesn't have vtables. I don't know if any of you noticed when you were doing your homework. I don't think it ever came up explicitly on the homework, but maybe when you were, you know, reading the manual or something, that CAML's integers are 31 bits long. Anyone notice that? Yeah, they're 31 bits long. And the reason why they're 31 bits long is that way the low order bit can always be a 1, and that way the garbage collector knows it's not a pointer. Because pointers on these systems are always word aligned, so a pointer would never to an object would never have a 1 there. And it turns out this is actually really efficient. Okay, so the problem with having that 1 there, there's two problems. One, if you really want 32-bit integers, it's a pain. Okay, but who needs it, right? You know, who needs that other 2 billion? The other problem is it slows down arithmetic, right? Because if I add two of these guys, now I'm going to have, in the sum, I'm going to have a zero there. But it turns out it's pretty fast that the way you do addition is you add the two integers and then you do a decrement. And decrements are really, really fast. Multiplication is much more complicated, but programs don't do a lot of integer multiplications. Anyway, none of this is important other than now you know why CAML ints are 31 bits long. It's so the garbage collector can tell an int from a pointer. So, there you go. Alright. This is what I was talking about with your question about trolling around and what you can and can't do in C. So first of all, you can conservatively garbage collect a C program. Turns out in practice, there's one conservative garbage collector that everyone uses, at least everyone I know. It was written by Hans Bohm, Alan Demers, and Mark Weiser. And it's called BDW, or the Bohm-Demers-Weiser Collector. And I just thought I'd tell you a couple details about how it works, because it's kind of interesting. One is, how does the garbage collector know object sizes? Well, you have to compile, you basically have to link in its version of malloc. Right? So the garbage collector knows how malloc works. So you don't get to use your favorite malloc implementation with the BDW collector. The collector has to provide the malloc. Okay? So that takes care of the size of objects. It's conservative, so it doesn't have to know where the pointers are. But it does have to know what objects are pointed to. So here is something that absolutely would not work. Okay, so I have some code here. It creates a pointer to 100 integers. Okay, so maybe there's some header word here. I forget what they actually do, so there's 100 here. Okay, then I take P and I add 1,000 to it. Okay? So P now points way over here. Can you see that? Okay? Well, guess what? If I garbage collect right here, this is going to look unreachable. And the collector is going to reclaim it. And it turns out that Brian Kernahan and Dennis Ritchie actually said you can't do that. You're not allowed to do that. Even if all your array bounds are in bounds. So you can't say P minus 950 equals 17. You're not allowed to do this. I'm not saying programs don't do it all the time, but programs that do it are going to break, and the collector is on the right side of the law. Okay. But here's what you are allowed to do in C. You are allowed to point just past the end. Okay. You are allowed to do that. And that was done so that you could write a for loop that does pointer arithmetic and goes from here to here to here to here and gets to the end, and then maybe another for loop that decrements it back. And they were worried that after you went just past the end, that still counts. You still point to the object. Okay? And you're allowed to do that. Okay? So that's kind of a pain for the collector. Because there might be another object right here. So it might think that you point to the wrong one, right? So it might keep this object around when it really wanted to keep this object around. Okay? There's basically two solutions to this. One is, every time you have a pointer, right between two objects, like to the beginning of one and past the other, just keep them both. And the other option is to use header words or add some pad byte in between so you can figure out where you are. Okay, questions?
How does the language prevent you from doing plus equals 1,000?
Oh, the same way C prevents you doing everything else. They put a line in the manual that says, if you do it, translation is wrong. Yeah.
Compiler will do it, won't they?
The compiler is part of the implementation, so it is allowed to do that. And the collector is assuming that the compiler never does. And this collector is something that basically does work as a link time library. And were a compiler to play these games, it could confuse the collector and cause it to do wrong. I don't have any knowledge of that happening in practice.
For memcopy, yeah. Sometimes they'll do that. They'll store like the difference between two pointers. So they'll throw out one pointer, they'll store the difference between two pointers and copy x plus, you know, a million.
There's those games. Another thing you cannot do with the Bohm-Demers Weiser collector, if you've ever seen this trick of how to store a doubly linked list with only half the pointers, you have to XOR the pointers together. That just won't work. You'll have these objects that are only reachable when you take these two values and exclusive OR them together, and that makes them look unreachable. So yeah, I'll find this paper that lists all this stuff and put it up, because you know when they went and wrote this stuff originally in the mid '80s, they thought of all this. They basically kind of had a list. So if your code does this, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah. Why do you think it is? And maybe I'm wrong, but why do you think it is that in the real world, no one really uses this?
So I think it's clear, actually, in my mind. Well, some of it is bias against garbage collection or whatever, but really, if your program is a good match for garbage collection, and it was written in the last 10 years, why was it written in C? I mean, I think that's the argument, right? You can say, well, because it was, 1978 and there wasn't anything better, in which case I actually think this is a fine solution, or your application isn't such a good match or doesn't seem to be a good match for garbage collection. All right, so that's the C world. Now I'm going to kind of go to the Java world and show you two ways to garbage collect. These are the two sort of primary ways. In practice, industrial strength garbage collectors are much more complicated. In fact, they're usually hybrids of these two approaches. But once you understand the basics, I think you know enough. And I kind of feel that even though garbage collectors are very, very complicated pieces of software in practice, they're incredibly not magical. They're based on very simple concepts, and there's basically two concepts. Okay? So the first one is copying collection, and as I'll explain it, this is basically a semi-space copier. So here's basically how it works. I'll do most of the drawing on the next slide. Just imagine that we take our whole memory. This is all of heap memory. The stack is somewhere else, but everywhere we're going to put our heap objects, our whole blob, and divide it in half. And we're never going to use more than half at once. Okay? That sounds like a huge cost. Yeah, you can do better, blah blah blah, but it's semi-space. That's the semi-space. We're only going to use half at once. Okay? All we're going to do is every time someone calls malloc or new or whatever you want to call it, we're just going to start here. And we're going to allocate however much room they need, maybe with an extra word that says the size of the object and all that stuff. And then we'll move our allocation pointer to there. Then we'll wait for the next object, and we'll go along. And we'll just keep going along until we hit the halfway point. Okay? And this isn't actually there. I mean, you detect it somehow, you check or whatever. And at this point, these are all objects that have not been reclaimed yet. And this is all empty. Okay? So we start from our roots. Wherever they are, you always go back to your roots. It's a joke. You find everything from the roots that points into here. Nothing's going to point into here. You're not using this memory, okay? And everything that's reachable, which means pointed to or recursively pointed to or pointed to back over here or pointed to, everything that's reachable, you copy over to this space, okay? So maybe the reachable stuff, if everything were reachable, we'd be full again. And now we're in trouble. But hopefully there's some stuff that's not reachable. So maybe we filled up this much space. And then we just start allocating from here. and we go to here, and when this fills up, we play exactly the same game, copying what's reachable over to here. Okay? Now this copying is a little more interesting than I said. When we move objects, we're literally moving objects. This object, assuming it's still reachable, is maybe now here. Okay? We also have to move all the pointers to it. So if it's pointed to by a root, we have to actually go into the stack and use mutation to make it point over here. And similarly, if this pointed to this object, and this object is now, say, here, then over here, in the new copy of the object, don't worry that the picture's getting all messed up, we have to also update it to there. So if you're algorithmically inclined, what we are doing is making a copy of the reachability graph. Right? Just think of these pointers as a graph, has a bunch of roots in the stack, and we're making a copy of that graph, an exact replica, and then we restart the program. Okay? And it's not going to be able to tell that we moved everything, provided that it can't read object addresses. We've updated all of our roots, and we're in really good shape. Okay? I'm going to go through in more detail how you actually do the copying, but I think it's nice to give the high-level view first. Okay? This system actually has some really, really nice properties. The first is that memory allocation is really, really cheap. You always have this nice contiguous space to allocate new objects into. And the other really nice thing is after you do a garbage collection, all of your reachable objects are right next to each other. Very few virtual memory pages, they fit in cat, all sorts of nice things. You always want your memory next to each other when you're single threaded. Okay? Questions about the basics? All right. So, there's two things we have to worry about. The first is, when we do this moving, how are we going to be able to update all these pointers correctly? I guess there's three. There's three bullets. The second one is, remember this cycle avoidance. This is the whole thing. When I'm making this copy of the graph, I have to preserve sharing, right? If there were two pointers to the same object, after I do the copy, they better still point to the same object. That's important to get right. And there's always this issue that when the garbage collector is running, it's because you ran out of space. Might be kind of hard to implement a garbage collector, right? So we have to be careful about how to use space. So there's a couple really, really cool techniques to get this all to work. One is called a chain EQ, and another is called forwarding pointers. And it's easiest to see with an example. So I did not draw an example in PowerPoint, so I'm just going to flip over to where I can draw this stuff. Okay? So let me now draw my from space. That's what I do over here. And this is my to space. So this is just so everything fits on a slide. These are my two semispaces. Okay? And maybe I'll just assume for simplicity I only have one root. Okay? And it points to this object, which maybe has two fields, one of which points to this object, and this guy just points back to the first object, and then also to this object, and maybe this guy just holds a number, and this guy points to this object. As you can see, I did not have this example prepared. And everything else is unreachable. So there's all these other objects, there's all these other objects everywhere, but they're not going to matter because we're never going to touch them. And once we've moved everything over, we'll just be over here, and then that will all get just, that's our new empty space. Okay? So here's what we do. We know to start that our two space is empty. So what we're going to do is we're going to have two pointers. Okay? And here's the key idea behind the Cheney Q. Cheney was the guy's name. He's not our vice president. or the guy I went to grad school with. It's the third Cheney I've never met. If you have two pointers in memory, you can treat everything between them as a queue. Okay? That seems simple enough. And that's going to be our queue of objects that we're still working on. So we start with this root, okay? And what we do is we make an exact copy of this object, and we move him down to here. Okay? So when we move this object down to here, let's see. this pointer still points to here, and this pointer still points to here. We just make a copy of the object. Now, having done that, we got to move our queue over. Right? Now this is our queue. Right? Now that our queue is not empty, we need to process the first guy in it. The way we process it is we follow all the pointers. Okay? And everything we find in the from space, we copy down into the queue. So we follow this pointer, we find this object, so we copy him down. Okay? So we copy him right here. He has two fields. His first field points to here. His second field points to here. Okay? Move the queue over. And now that I've copied him, why did I copy him? I copied him because of this pointer in this space. So now I need to do two things. The first thing I need to do is I need to update this pointer. So he does not point here anymore. He now points here. All right? Don't worry if you've lost track of the objects. The point is, after I move something into the queue, why did I move it there? Because somebody pointed to him, and that pointer needs to be updated. And similarly, and I guess I should have done this before, I need to update the root to that first object. Make sense? People with me? Now there's another thing I need to do. And this is the cycle avoidance and the sharing preservation. What if somebody else points to this already moved object or this already moved object? We need to tell them that it's already been moved. Right? It's already been moved. Don't put it in the queue again. That's wrong. Don't copy it again. We have to preserve sharing. Right? So the way we do that, and this is like the final trick, is what we do is just take the first field of the object, or the header word if you like, and have it point to wherever you moved it. Okay? So why does that work? Well, what's going to happen at some point is some object from up here is going to get copied into the queue. And when it gets copied into the queue, it's going to have some blue pointers in it for things that have already been moved down. And it's going to have some old black pointers for things that haven't been moved down yet. Right? And as I go through the queue, if I hit a blue pointer, don't do anything. That object's already been moved. I already point to the new object. But if I hit a black pointer, move the object down into the queue, change the black pointer into the blue pointer, and add the new blue pointer up in the from space. And now the question, to see if you've been paying attention, how can you tell if a pointer is black or blue?
The memory address.
Yeah. You just look at its address. This is half of memory, this is half. You can just tell by where it points.
So whenever you put in the blue pointers, they're just dummy values, right?
No, they are the new... up here in the old space?
Yeah.
They're just for the purpose of knowing that something's already been copied down and where it's been copied.
You could put just like a 0 or a 1.
No, you can't, and here's why. Because somebody already in the queue may need to know where that object has moved.
Okay.
It's already been moved down, but somebody needs to know where.
So you put it down to where it got moved. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And you need to know that they are pointers, right? I mean...
Yes. Okay. Yes, I'm assuming I can distinguish pointers from integers. Assume we're using the camel trick. If I ever see anything with a low bit of 1, just copy it down. Don't update anything. and the conservative collector, like for C, does not use copying for this exact reason.
Okay.
I told you this was one of two fundamental garbage collection techniques. This is the one less appropriate for conservative collection. I am embarrassed by my drawing, but I hope you're able to follow it along as I went. Okay? It is a very elegant queue algorithm, despite my picture. Okay? Questions about this?
So
Yeah. So in practice, do you really do, you don't really do any pre-processing on the memory queue. You just start at the root and just start thinking of the copies. And when you're done, you're done.
Yep. You know you're done when the queue is empty again. Right? When the queue is, so what happened is after I processed this object, I never showed in my picture moving the back pointer, the back of the queue. But that's just moving as I go field by field. At some point, the two queue pointers match up again. At that point, everything's been copied. The queue pointers become my allocation pointer for future allocations, and this entire space is available for when I get to my next collection.
So when you run out of the half memory, is that out of memory, or does the program say, well, I'll give you the other half, I just can't garbage collect anymore?
In the pure semi-space collector, they just, if you do all, if you ever fill up all of half of memory, and everything is reachable, they can start playing, I mean, they can start playing games, you know, of, well, I hope by the next time, you know, using more than half, you can do these things. It turns out, if you get more than about two-thirds full, even though you can keep doing this game, and there are tricks you can play, you spend all your time garbage collecting anyway, so your program's running so slow, you may as well stop. What really happens is, garbage collectors decide to run, let's say, I'm going to try to run in 4 meg. All right? Well, maybe that's 2 meg and 2 meg. Well, if that fills, I'll just use up more, I'll just ask the operating system for more memory. And yeah, I'm going to take more pages, maybe I need to swap out to disk, but at least I can keep running. So this full is a very relative notion. Okay, garbage collectors tend to say, I'll try to run in 4 meg, and if that doesn't work, I'll try bigger. And these runtime flags I was talking about let you specify things like your initial heap size, your maximum heap size. Sometimes they even have an aggressiveness factor, like how eager should a garbage collector be to grow the size of the heap. So this running out of memory is a very relative notion, especially if you have an 80 gigabyte disk that can be used for swap. Right? I mean, at that point, like, it's pretty hard to run out for a desktop application.
So this can actually change the ordering of the objects, so you lose, like, the allocation locality.
Right.
Does that cause any... But also, you get sort of a different kind of locality, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Performance problems, or...?
Many people believe... This is very black art sort of stuff, okay? So the question, right, if object... Back when objects were allocated, they were right next to each other, which is really nice from a locality perspective. If I call new twice in a row, I know the objects are next to each other. But after I garbage collect, they might not be, and I might lose locality. On the other hand, if I have some linked list, after garbage collection, they tend to all be right next to each other, which is really great. So most people I talk to believe that garbage collection, copying garbage collection improves locality overall. But, I mean, it depends on the program. So much of this is heuristic and depends on application behavior. You can easily create examples either way. All right. I bet I said everything on the... Oh, that's not the right thing. There we go. All right. The chain EQ is just the two pointers in two space. This is really, really nice, because it turns out that's about all the garbage collector needs to run. Okay? The garbage collector can basically be written in one tail recursive loop, just keep processing the queue, which is really nice, because you really don't want your garbage collector having to call new. That's really complicated. You don't want to deal with it. Okay? And these forwarding pointers were really all about detecting cycles. We're all about, I've already moved this object, I need to maintain object identity. If I had 17 pointers to this object before collection, I need to have 17 pointers to the object after collection. And since this has already been moved, here's where it got moved to. Okay? And we got the question of how you can tell forwarding pointers from non-forwarding pointers, because you just look at the address. Okay? So that's half of garbage collection. Actually, that's half of fundamental garbage collection techniques. Okay? The other technique is perhaps simpler to understand, so I figured I'd do it second. Here's what you basically do. No more dividing things in half. Just allocate stuff wherever you can in all of memory. And when you run out of space, first do a pass where you go and find everything reachable. Okay? And what you do is, and I'm going to assume that every object has some bits that only the garbage collector can play with. Okay? And systems that use mark sweep collection usually do reserve in a header word a bit or two for the garbage collector. Even if you just have a class pointer, they'll still use those two low order bits, which are sure to be zero, just for the garbage collector. And don't worry, when the garbage collector is done, it's going to put everything back where it found it. Okay? So it goes in and starts from the roots. You always start with your roots. Oh, sorry, you always go back to your roots. And it goes and finds something, finds the object, and it just sets a little mark bit, just changes a bit from 0 to 1, and follows all of its pointers, again, knowing where the pointers are, and marks it all. Okay? So when it's all done with this recursive procedure, it's marked everything that's reachable. Avoiding cycles is very easy. Okay? As soon as you hit something that's already been marked, don't mark it again, don't follow its objects. It's already been marked. Okay? So now I have everything that's marked, and now I enter the sweep phase, where I just literally troll through memory. I'd make a linear pass saying, ah, here's a 20-byte object that is marked. So I will keep it, advance my pointer 20 bytes, and ah, here's a 12-byte object that is not marked. I will reclaim it, advance by 12 bytes, and continue. Tiny little detail, clear the mark bits as you go so that they're all clear the next time you go to garbage collection, and you're done. Questions about the basics? Okay. Seems easy. Yeah, Matt.
You can just choose to mark it with a zero next time. That's the same as clearing it, right?
Yeah, except if these are class pointers, you really want to do whatever. Yeah, yeah. And then if you do that, everything that was unreachable, you have to set as you sweep it. So it actually costs you. You wouldn't want to do that. Okay? All right. This sounds a lot easier. People love this. They're like, oh, it's so much easier. It sounds like you're not wasting half of your space. So it sounds great for that. It took me a lot less time to explain. People use it all the time. I don't mean to denigrate mark sweep. It works great. People use it a lot, but it is not a free lunch. Okay? So first of all, again, you don't really want to, you saved space because you don't have to reserve half. Turns out you really don't want to be running programs that need more than about half, or typically two-thirds. Okay? But that's just a performance thing. Much more important is that allocation just got a lot more complicated. Okay? I just did this mark sweep phase, so now I got my live objects here, 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 and here, and everything else is free. And now I need to allocate a 20-byte object, please. Where do I go? I got to go searching around. I got to find 20 bytes. And what happens is, in our copying world, we knew exactly where we were going to allocate objects. We had a contiguous space from here to the end of our semi-space. In a mark sweep world, we have to maintain much more sophisticated data structures to remember where the free objects are, where the free space is. Can it be done? Absolutely. There's nothing wrong with it. But if you just focus on garbage collection, mark sweep looks much, much easier than copying, and it's just not true. Okay. The other thing is actually a performance thing related to the same thing, and that is this issue of fragmentation. Okay. So I think the easiest way to explain fragmentation is with the worst case example. Okay. So let me show you the worst case example, and then I think you'll probably just get it. Okay. So the worst case example is this is all of memory. And there's this pathological program that allocates 1-byte objects until all of memory is full. So 1-byte objects. 1-byte, 1-byte, 1-byte. It allocates a lot of 1-byte objects. But you know, here's the craziest thing about these 1-byte objects it allocates. There's some global linked list of every 10th one. Okay, they can't actually 1-bytes. They have to hold pointers. But okay, like this. Those are all 10. I know I can't count. Okay, and nothing else is reachable. So we run the garbage collector, and it frees up this, and this, and this, and oops, I missed one. And this, okay, and we're very excited because we run mark sweep, and 90% of memory is now available. But the next call to malloc asks for 10 bytes. Okay? So we're using exactly 10% of memory, and we have to give an out-of-memory exhaustion error. And that's this fragmentation in a nutshell. And it doesn't happen in practice, but it happens a little bit in practice. Whereas in copying collection, it doesn't happen at all, but you spend all this time moving around objects, and wasn't that complicated, and didn't that have cost? Okay? Oh, and to get back to your locality question, after the collection, you have lots of locality, but during the collection, you're moving all this stuff to very cold memory. Questions about fragmentation?
So is this actually a harder problem in the Mark Sweep collector than it is just for a normal heap?
Is it a hard... I would argue no. It's certainly less under programmer control, right? Because this is all hidden from you, and you can't do your own stuff. Yeah, fragmentation comes up with malloc and free, right? So the garbage collector was the one that decided that 90% was available. But in a malloc-free world, the programmer could have decided that 90% was available. I guess you could argue that in an explicit world, you could choose to make a copy. You could realize that your list was very badly, it was spread all through memory, and you could try to make a more compact copy. Okay? Yes?
And why wouldn't you just, like, as you're marking and sweeping,
fantastic question. That's exactly what they do. And those are called mark sweep compact collectors. The compact being the move stuff over as you do it. You're now back to some of the complications of moving. Okay? As you move, what about the guy? So you move this guy over, that's fine, and you update this. Also, but then just like with copying, you better leave a forwarding pointer.
Okay, so the point of mark and sweep is you don't have to mess with the pointer.
Yeah, you don't have to do all the forwarding pointers, but they're absolutely... And what typically happens, I think, in practice is you don't compact every time you mark sweep, but every once in a while you do.
So the moment you start moving things around in memory, you have to have accurate collection, otherwise you're in danger of changing your int that just happened to have...
Absolutely. There are collectors called mostly copying collectors, where the mostly is optimistic, where what you basically say is... I don't always know what is an int is a pointer, but if I know that none of my maybe ints point to this thing, then I can move it. So you can try to finagle it a bit, but absolutely, if you have something that looks like a pointer to an object, but might actually be an integer, you cannot move the pointer to object.
Do you know what does C-sharp do?
Do I know what C-sharp does? Well, okay, so first I have to be pedantic and say C-sharp's a language. You have to tell me about C-sharp implementation. Do I know what the implementation does? I don't know.
It's a generational mark sweep copying collector with concurrent and parallel GC.
Yeah.
Lots of knobs.
Lots of knobs. Everything in one. I'm going to show, these are the basic techniques. I want to tell you, at least at a high level, what some of the very important bells and whistles do. And it has them all.
Okay.
Do I say this on the next slide? Okay. All right. So, I thought this was on the next slide. So, everything I've shown you for the last 15 minutes was invented in 1960. Maybe it was in the late 50s, but apparently mark sweep and copying were both published in 1960, and we've been teaching Cheney keys ever since. I think actually Cheney keys might be a little bit later, like people did copying a little less efficiently, but they were still doing copying. Okay? And lo and behold, in the mid-80s, someone came along and did generational garbage collection.
On your
What's that?
Your screen's not updating.
Oh. Uh-oh. We'll see if I try it again if it comes back. Rod? Is he asleep in there?
Yeah, I usually.
I'm running fine. I'm not getting update here.
It's fine here.
It's fine there. Okay, it's just in this room. And I'm on slide 27, if that helps.
My wireless network went down so a little bit. Is anything to be
okay?
I hope it's not a statement on the University of Washington computer science department how reliable our own software is.
Yeah. They tell me actually this quarter has been pretty good.
I could tell some ugly stories about this software.
Yeah.
Every software is unreliable at some point. Come on. It's just the way software is.
The garbage collector just kicked in there.
Yeah.
Don't you work at Boeing talking about unreliable software?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
well,
you.
You
I think we're all
crash.
All good. Okay. Let me just erase everything. Okay. So generational garbage collection was a huge advance. And it was based on, again, heuristic things that may be absolutely false for a given program, but are really, really true in practice. Okay? And the big one is that most objects die young. Okay? You create a bunch of objects in your object-oriented or functional language. Most of them are going to die immediately. You're going to use them for like 10 microseconds, and you're never going to use them again. And those that do live a long time tend to live an even longer time. So it's very much not like human beings. Right? It's like if you're young, you're most likely to die, and the old stuff just lives longer. Okay? And it's very unlikely that some old object is going to point to a new object. In fact, the only way an old object could ever point to a new object is via mutation. If some object was born after you, you have to be changed to point to it. Okay? So in functional languages, mutation is very, very rare. And it turns out, even in object-oriented languages, it's more rare than you might think. And in fact, when you're programming against a generational collection, this is my last chance in the course to brag about functional programming. Mutation costs you more than you think. Okay? So, how do we exploit these insights, these heuristics, which could be absolutely false for your program? What we do is we have most of our heap up here. And you can use whatever you want over there. Maybe semi-space copying, maybe Mark Suite, maybe some combination. But then we have the nursery. Nursery is where objects are born. Okay? And what we do is here we just do the copying thing, where we just allocate objects into the nursery. Now what we'd like to do is when the nursery fills up, we'd like to very quickly promote or tenure or age any objects that are live up to here, and then just delete everything else and start back over from the nursery. So here's the naive view. What if we just took our roots, because you always go back to your roots, and just did our plain old reachability, ignoring the heap up here? That would save us a lot of time, because this is where most of the objects are. They're probably going to live a long time. So most of the objects are up here. So let's just look at these guys, move up anything that's reachable, finish everything else. Now, there's only two problems with this. One, eventually, the old space is going to fill up. But we just spent 20 minutes on that. But the point is not to do it too often. Okay? What's the other problem?
Mutation.
It is possible that something up here might point to something down here. And in that case, we got to keep the pointed to thing. Because this might be reachable. And the only way to find out would be to do a full-blown garbage collection. And that's exactly what we're trying to avoid. So what we do, in order to preserve the benefits of nursery collection, is we make mutation more expensive than it used to be. And what we do is every time there's a mutation in our program, every time there's a write to an object field, we see if it's in the old space. And if it is, we store in a little list off to the side that address. Okay, so we remember address A, we point to it. And when it comes to garbage collection time, we just treat this as some extra roots. Okay. This is called the remembered set, and there are lots of techniques. It turns out if you don't want an explicit list, you can play all sorts of tricks. But this is, I think actually most of the world has realized that an explicit remembered set isn't such a big deal. Yes.
Why wouldn't you just point directly into the nursery? Because then you only have to point to the nursery object once.
Ah, the reason is you might have a very hot field that gets mutated a lot. So if it gets mutated to lots of things in the nursery, you don't want to keep them all. You only want to keep what it points to at collection time. So you just put it in the remembered set once.
You also need to be able to update that pointer once you move those, that object out of the nursery.
Ah, That's true. Yes. I was going to repeat exactly what you said, but then I realized everyone could hear you. Alright. So that's generational collection. It was a big advance. In fact, you know, it's probably one of the things that made, by the time we got to the 90s, garbage collection was ready for industrial strength implementations. Okay. Alright. So what have we done? We've sketched the basics of copying in Mark Sweep. We have added this generational complication, which turns out to be really, really useful in practice. And now let me, since this is kind of like the last, there's only one more slide on garbage collection, I'll just throw a bunch more terms at you. For other things that, other adjectives that describe garbage collectors. So far, you can now go home and, you know, your spouse will say, what did you learn tonight? And you say, well, I learned that you can build an accurate copying generational garbage collector. Right? Because you can pick and choose, you know, your adjectives. There's some other orthogonal things you can choose to have your garbage collector do. So here's one. Incremental. Here's one thing people hate about garbage collectors. While your program is garbage collecting, you can kind of tell because it's not doing anything else. Which if you're a desktop application is kind of annoying, right? You go to move the mouse and it doesn't move because you're busy garbage collecting. If you're flying an airplane, it can be a little more than annoying. Okay? It's very hard to meet real-time guarantees if you can have large pauses from your garbage collector. So what you do is instead of saying, oh, I'm out of space, I guess I'll garbage collect everything, you interleave. So you do a little bit of programming, you do a little bit of garbage collection, you do a little bit of programming, a little bit of garbage collection. The hard part is to make sure, under reasonable assumptions, that you let the garbage collector do enough work that it can keep up with the program. So you never really run out of space. Okay? It's called incremental collection. By the way, in this world, the program is called the mutator. Because people who write garbage collectors are just trying to con them, you know, the program is called the mutator. That's all they care about. It's that evil thing that changes things on me and asks for new memory. And if they're just, you know, it's the old, like, you know, school would be so easy without the students. It's kind of like, you know, garbage collection would be so easy without the mutator. You know, never mind, that's the thing that, like, yeah.
Doesn't a garbage collector have to do a certain amount of work or it'll be absolutely wrong? Like, if the program is changing certain bits of memory, so it's like, I mean, how small can you make that garbage collection piece?
It's a good question, and I'm not going to teach you incremental GC, but basically instead of having two semi-spaces, you break things down into smaller pages, you make conservative assumptions about what might be on other pages, but then you need summary information so you can eventually collect things. It's a mess. But it's a pretty elegant mess. It keeps a lot of people busy and employed. And it beats writing Malikan free. Okay, so now we get to the question of, we spent 2 hours, 2.5 hours on threads, and everything I've said has been assuming a single thread here. Okay, so it turns out that the simple thing to do is to go stop the world. Okay, so you can have a multi-threaded program, and when it's time to garbage collect, stop all your threads and garbage collect. And the problem is this doesn't scale. Okay. It doesn't scale to many processors because it takes quite a bit of time to stop everybody and start them back up. Okay? So the solution is concurrent garbage collection where at the exact same moment, one processor is running the mutator and another one's running the garbage collector. And if you thought incremental was hard, you should see concurrent. Okay? At the very moment you're trying to find out if something is, you know, how big some object is, someone else needs a new object. And you're trying to follow some pointer and somebody's mutating the pointer. And you have to use synchronization now, not just between mutator threads, but between the collector and the mutator. And this is done by the runtime system. Okay? The basics of concurrent GC, also early 80s, actually. I think it preceded generational, though I probably shouldn't say that without checking. Okay? Very weird use of terms, and it's only a garbage collector thing. When people say parallel garbage collection, they don't mean what I just said. They mean that the actual garbage collection task has been parallelized. So instead of having one garbage collector thread, you have more than one. And they're running at the same time. And that is also difficult. Right? It was pretty easy when we had one little chainy queue. Now try having five. Where do they all go? How do they all communicate everybody's forwarding pointers? Because we still have this issue of all the forwarding pointers have to agree and so on. Okay? So it can be done, and it's complicated. Lots of phrases I haven't used. It turns out that you don't want to go sweep through your entire memory when you're doing mark sweep. It just has terrible locality effects. So you do it lazily. Basically, every time someone calls new, you do a little bit of sweeping. So it's another kind of incremental trick. It turns out that garbage collectors don't do well with very large objects. Okay, if you go and ask for a 32K array, that's very large to a garbage collector. Garbage collectors tend to be engineered for those dinky little 16-byte objects. So they do fine with 32 kilobyte arrays. I'm not telling you don't use them. Just know that they're not doing any of the stuff I've been sketching here. They keep all those large objects off to the side where they can handle them specially, and that's usually called the LOS, or the large object space. Okay. They keep those fat guys out of the room. Okay. And lots, lots more. You can actually teach an entire course on garbage collection. You know, P505GC. Okay. Except for this concurrent and parallel stuff, a wonderful survey paper from 92 by one of the experts in the field goes through everything I did more with much better drawings than I'm capable of, and you're welcome to read it. It's very good. There's entire academic conferences with lots of industrial people, whatever, dedicated just to garbage collection. Okay. The things I want you to know are basically not the details of how copying works or mark sweep or any of that. I want you to know what reachability means. The fact that when you're programming a garbage collected language, objects can move on you, but you can't tell. That mutation may have an extra cost because of generational collection. That you can leak in a garbage collected language, but not by the strict definition of what space leak means, and so on. And on top of all that, I just want you to know that garbage collectors are not magic, but they are a very niche business. They're kind of like how, most car mechanics don't, work on race cars. Most programmers don't work on garbage collectors. And I fundamentally believe that race car mechanics are not better mechanics. They just really know how to work on race cars. Okay. Yeah.
How much does the operating system cooperate with the runtime in these systems?
Remarkably little in practice. I know of one paper published last summer in a programming language conference about some of these issues. What you'd really like to do, for example, is if some garbage collector, really what you want to communicate with is your pager. Okay? So let's say some garbage collector runs through a virtual memory page, decides everything is garbage. You would really like to say to the OS, like, take it. I'm done with it. Well, what do normal OS heuristics do? They say, oh, this page has been recently accessed. I will keep it in your working set. But the garbage collector knows it's not going to be used again. So you want some of that cooperation, and as far as I know, there is some, but primarily ongoing work on getting the OS involved in these engineering issues. Yep.
Seems like maybe there's another thing, too, which is you could, if you're trying to move something, and you have some outstanding I.O. to that buffer, you could really be in trouble.
We assume a garbage collection. So again, let's just imagine stop the world. We filled up memory, now we're going to garbage collect. There's also this issue that you really want to garbage collect at what's called a safe point. You want your running code to be at a reasonable program counter. Now, in the single-threaded world, as long as all your calls to new are reasonable program counters, you're fine. Because what's the point in garbage collecting before somebody asks for a new object? But in a multi-threaded world, it's a much bigger deal to get everybody to safe points. Okay? But it turns out, by the way, you also want to get everybody safe points before you handle asynchronous signals and all this sort of stuff. So. Still a question? Yep.
I'm just surprised you didn't talk about just what I thought is the best garbage collection paper ever, which uh-huh. talks about how reference counting and garbage collection are the same algorithm.
Oh, yeah.
Costs are different time.
Yeah, so this is, it's funny you mention it. It's actually one of my favorite papers from the last 5 years. This was in Uppsala 04, 05. It's called A Unified Theory of Garbage Collection. It's by David Bacon, Perry Chang, and my apologies to the other couple people at IBM who are authors. I forget which other couple are on it. And I'm going to talk about reference counting in just a second. And they show this very, very deep thing, that fundamentally what garbage collectors are doing is doing reachability over what's still live, and what reference counting is doing reachability over what's now dead. And the reason why nobody noticed this for 45 years was that they do it at very different times. garbage collection is very, very lazy. It doesn't do reachability until garbage collection time, whereas reference counting, which I'm going to talk about in a couple minutes, does things very, very eagerly. It's constantly finding what's no longer reachable, tracing through the dead stuff. And if you did garbage collection reachability earlier or reference counting reachability later, it is this amazing duality where they're tracing exactly complementary memory. I love that paper. It's a little mathy, though. That's why I didn't mention it. I mean, it's much mathier than this. This sticks to the bits.
I liked it mostly because I was really against garbage collection until I read it.
Okay. Yeah.
But reference counting can't deal with cycles away.
That's right. And that comes out in the paper as well, yeah.
But all good reference counters do deal with cycles, which makes them really similar to garbage collectors.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's see, so I do have 10 more slides, because remember, this was just one way to do safe memory management, so I have this other stuff. I'm willing to take 5 minutes, but you guys had 20 minutes per course of hours. How do people feel? People going to hang in if we... Less class, just plow on through? All right. Okay, so what happens is, I've actually done a fair amount of research on safe memory management that's not garbage collection. So what happens is people get someone, like they find someone like on some interview, say it, you know, like saying into the camera, like, well, the only way to have safe memory management is a garbage collector. And then I get emails saying, like, go beat some sense into this guy. And so, you know, it's a reasonable point. It's a common misconception, and that's okay. It is definitely the easiest way, like I said before. Okay? So what else might we do? I'll show you three ways. Go through these pretty quickly, and then I want to show you regions. So here's one way. So we don't have garbage collection. So let's just restrict you as the programmer in what you can write. And if we restrict you enough, then for certain objects, maybe not for all of memory, but at least for the ones we're restricting you, you won't be able to dereference a dangling pointer. How are we going to do it? We're going to use a type system, or we're going to have a language restriction, or we're going to use some other runtime technique, or whatever. Okay? And you can mix these all together. I've built languages that have, you know, 6 different memory management idioms. Okay? And as long as you know for which object, which idiom you're dealing with, and how they all interact, you're fine. And I would argue we've already done this. We already have, in everything I've shown you, 2 memory management idioms. The stack idiom, objects are reclaimed and you hit the curly brace, and the heap idiom, which is garbage collection or malloc and free or whatever. And there are other ones, and they're worth knowing. Okay? All right. So, here's how unique pointers work. Let's suppose that P, some pointer P, is the only pointer to the object. If we somehow knew that, if we somehow could enforce that, then let's just let you call free. Provided that after we do that, what if we had free, what if we had it, I don't know, say actually take the address of P. And then what it did was free the allocated space and then set star P equal to null. Sorry, star address, set P equal to null. But the only way to set it to null is to pass its address. Okay? Well, now you're not going to be able to dereference a dangling pointer because there was only one reference to the object and we nulled it out. Okay? It's just that simple. It's not that hard when unique pointers are appropriate to enforce it. The way to enforce it dynamically, again, the rule for unique pointer enforcement, there's always exactly one pointer to an object. A uniquely pointed to object. So if we do P equal Q, we better also set Q to null, just like we did on free of Q. These are sometimes called destructive reads, because when you read Q, you destroyed it. Okay? When this is appropriate for certain memory objects, I highly recommend using it. Whether as a programming idiom, or as a library, or as smart pointers, you know, some sort of operator overloading. But it has limited applicability. Because unique pointers can only be used to build trees. You can build lists and trees, but you can't build DAGs. Right? If all you have are unique pointers, you're never allowed multiple pointers to the same object, and that rules out a lot of interesting data structures. Okay? No cycles, no DAGs, no anything. Okay? So it works, it's nice, but it's of limited applicability. I should add that I focused on the dynamic here. There's also the static. What we could do is not actually do the assignment to null, but use some sort of fancy static analysis or type system that realized that after you did free of P, you can't use P anymore. Okay? Again, this is only sound with a unique pointer. Where soundness here is ensuring safety, which means preventing dangling pointer dereferences. If there could be another pointer to this object, it is not sufficient to disallow subsequent access to P. We can still have a dangling pointer dereference through the other alias. Okay? So that's unique pointers. More flexible and less efficient is reference counting, like we were talking about. So your basics of dynamic reference counting is with every object, you store a number, which is how many pointers there are to it. So when you see P equals Q, if this is Q, you increase the counter to this object. You also better decrease the count on the object that P used to point to. They point to the same object, you'll just do a decrement and increment and be back to where you started. And now when you go to zero, you can free the object because you've just destroyed the last reference to it. Okay. This is reasonably easy to automate. So oftentimes programmers have to do this manually. They can also do it in an automated fashion. People tend to know a lot about reference counting. I was talking with a colleague of mine who is one of these absolute GC experts. He said he went everywhere to try to find large applications that use reference counting, and he found remarkably few. Everyone thinks they're out there, and he thinks it's just used a lot less than people think. I was very surprised by this.
Microsoft Palm is totally based around reference counting, right? And like Windows is a large application that uses Palm, so that's.
But it's for the COM objects, right? It's not for the memory objects, right? So reference counting for other resources, I agree. I think he meant for, intro process, main memory, stuff. Yeah.
Common use for virtualization
objects. Okay.
It's like sometimes that's on your own interface that some of those objects are exposed.
Okay.
Every Visual Basic 6 application ever written, of which UP6, I think, is still one of the...
Okay.
Just surpassed Fortran as the world's most popular
one. I'll debug it, because, he spends a month last summer out in Microsoft. So, okay, I'll let him know. I'll tell him every VB6 application because of the prosaic object in COM. I'll let him know. I won't say his name because I'm on the internet. Henry. All right. The other thing people tend to know about reference counting is if you create a cycle of objects, let's just do it now. It's not to a self cycle. It's too pathological. Okay. If you create a cycle of objects and destroy the last reference to this cyclic list, then this reference count drops from 2 to 1. This one is 1, this one is 1. We don't reclaim objects till reference counts drop to 0. This now is unreachable, and it was not reclaimed, and it has infinite drag time. It's a true space leak. So there are ways to try to find cycles. As you go to find cycles, you end up employing techniques that look a heck of a lot like Mark Sweep. Or if you don't have those techniques and you tell the programmer you're just going to have to deal with this, it's up to the programmer to, before losing this last reference, to break the cycle. Okay, that's worth knowing. Okay, it's also worth knowing that systems that automate reference counting do not, on every assignment of P equals Q, where these are local variables, go and increment a reference count and decrement a reference count. It's just way too expensive. So they'll do things so they'll wait till the end of the basic block or the end of the function and then do a bunch of reference count fix-ups. But in the meantime, you can't reclaim any objects because you may have deferred some increments that are very, very important. Okay? Just so you know, it's not quite as inefficient as everyone thinks, but it's pretty bad. Okay? All right. Much more interesting from my perspective and I think much more useful and less known is an idiom that has language support. I'll provide a couple pointers for you, as well as it's just used in a lot of libraries. It's called regions. It's also known as zones and arenas and probably a bunch of other things. It's been reinvented many times over the decades. But in the last 10 to 15 years has really started seeing more language support as well as real heavy-duty library support. So regions are a very basic idea that on the surface accomplish nothing. But when you start using them, you realize they accomplish a lot. All we're going to do is we're going to partition memory into explicit regions. So in my picture, the regions are the circles and the objects are the little squares in them. So every object is in exactly one region. That's what I mean by partition. Okay? And whenever you want, you the programmer, or you the runtime system, whatever, you can create a new region. So you come along, you make a new circle. And that's fine. But now how are you going to put new objects in it? Well, it turns out we also give you a handle. That's what I've used these little blue objects for. And that's just your way of talking about the region. Okay, just like when we created threads, we had thread IDs that let you talk about the thread. And when you go to create a new object, I told you that every object has to go in a region. You better pass a handle so that we know what region to put that new object into. So if you pass this handle, the new object is in here. Okay. Now, I haven't said anything about what objects can point to what other objects. I've tried to indicate that with these arrows here. It's fine to have intra-region pointers. It's fine to have inter-region pointers. But as far as safe memory management goes, we're going to treat those two kinds of pointers pretty differently. Okay? So the key advantage of going to a region-based approach is that our intra-region pointers, we're going to be able to forget about. And the reason why we're going to be able to forget about them is that we can free a region, which frees everything in the region, but we can't free individual objects. Okay? So this is way back at the beginning when I said, why would you ever want drag time? This is exactly why. We're going to get very cheap deallocation of the whole region, but we're not going to be able to say, oh, I'm done with these objects in the region. Uh-uh. Now, what do you do in practice if you're in that situation? You take all the ones you're not done with, you make a copy of them, and then you can deallocate the region. But you have to do it manually. The system's not going to do it for you. Questions about this basic picture?
So you can basically write your own mini garbage collector.
Yeah. Yeah, you can. As long as you know, as long as you can find your roots. Yeah. You can do it. Okay. First point, I think people don't emphasize this enough. You can totally make a new region for every object, in which case we've accomplished nothing. The whole advantage is when you start putting multiple objects in one region. And like I said before, intra-region pointers can never lead to dangling pointer dereferences. If you're intra-region, you and the object you point to will be deallocated at the same moment in time. So that pointer, you know, that thing you're pointing to, would never lead to a dangling pointer dereference, because that object's not going to be there yet either. Okay? The other thing is that it's really pretty darn easy to avoid space leaks. Just don't lose these handles. If you can manage to keep track of the handles, you can manage to deallocate everything and not have space leaks. And again, in theory, this is no easier than keeping track of all the objects. In practice, it's a lot easier. Because these individual objects, you can lose as much as you want. Just think, I've got the handle, I know where it is, I'll be able to deallocate everything later. So you go to do some complicated algorithm, create some scratch region, just put a bunch of junk in it, lose track of stuff wherever you want, but keep that handle, know when you're done with the objects, and deallocate it. Okay? Yes?
Do partitions tend to expand dynamically?
Yes. Yeah, I don't think I have a slide on that. Yeah, just because I was trying to keep things short, because I didn't know how much time I'd have. It turns out that you can do every one of these, all three of these operations in order one time. Because the way you actually do these circles is as a linked list of fixed size pages. Okay? So new object just moves the allocation pointer in one of the pages, just like in our copy and collection. If you're at the end of a page, just go grab a new one. Okay? New region just finds a new page. And free region just takes that whole list of pages and splices it back into the list. You can actually do it in constant time. And again, large objects get kept off to the side because large objects are always a pain and ruin the engineering of everything else. Okay. So intra-region pointers are great. What about the inter-region pointers? Okay. So now there's a number of things we could do. One is we could reference count them. This is going to be a lot more efficient because hopefully a lot of our regions are a lot of our pointers are intra-region. Hopefully it's a lot easier to find cycles because we've simplified the situation just to the inter-region pointers. Okay. There are a lot of ideas along these lines in the real-time specification for Java. That's what that is. It's also this very nice piece of work called RC. This was out of Berkeley. I put a link up to the paper today on basically doing this for the inter-region pointers. Another possibility, which was basically a big part of my PhD, was a type system that says when you create a pointer, you say in its type what region you point to. Okay? And so now we don't even have to worry about dangling pointer dereferences. We know what region you point to, and we know that after that region is deallocated, we're not going to let you dereference. The trade-off is now not all int pointers are created equal. So you can't just take two int pointers, P and Q, and do the assignment. You can only do that if their types say they point into the same region. And that's a huge restriction. It restricts the pointer graphs that you're allowed to write down. That's always what type systems do. They always restrict what a program can do. And the argument is that to give programmers control over memory management while maintaining safety, it's actually good to take programs away from them. If they don't want that, they can use a garbage collector. That was another option in the system. But there are type systems that basically enforce that after a region has been deallocated, no pointers into it can be used anymore. And this is another reason why I always emphasize, and I put it in blueprint, dangling pointers aren't a problem. Dangling pointer dereferences are. Because region systems, which I did not invent, often allow dangling pointers without allowing them to be dereferenced. Okay? There's actually an implementation, not of CAML, but of standard ML, where they don't use a garbage collector at all. They just use automatic regions. So you just program an ML like you always have, and they figure out where to create regions and destroy them. And it's pretty amazing, and it would take me hours to tell you how it works. Okay?
What's the name of that?
Yeah, that's the ML kit. The ML kit, yes. Okay. So let me just show you one common idiom without the type system support or anything like that. So let's just look at this C code. Okay. So the way this C code works is that G needs to compute some really complicated answer. And based on its arguments, it might have to create a really big data structure, a really large, small one. It might create cycles. It might create trees. It might create an array of 4,000 characters. It doesn't know. It depends on its arguments. Okay? But it does know, given its arguments, what to compute. On the flip side, it has no idea how long the caller needs the answer. Okay? So this is, I would argue, a very common situation in programming where the callee knows the structure and size of the answer, and the caller knows the lifetime of the answer. Okay? And regions do this really well. Just have the caller create a region, pass the handle to the callee, get the result back, use the result for as long as you want, and then free the region. And I would argue that if C had this language construct, you would see a lot less of gosh, I hope this is big enough. All right. Pass it to the callee. And this is really funny now because now we teach everyone not to do this. But we didn't used to teach people because it was so much more efficient than malloc and free. And so, All right.
I think they use bigger buffers now.
Yeah, use bigger buffers. Yeah, they're up to, just add a zero. Okay, now we're okay. Questions about memory management, regions, etc.? Alright. We're doing really well on time. I decided I would give you a 2-page course summary, and then we'll have time for questions. I can stick around if people have questions, related to the final or just about life, computer science, or compilers, in increasing order of Dan's expertise. I would say that basically what we've been doing is we've been defining programming languages, right? And we stuck with really small ones, ones that if at the beginning of the course you realized just how small they were, you'd be like, well, this is going to be easy, until we actually tried to do it, right? And we just learned that defining languages is really hard. And in doing it, we took a couple different tacks. All the way from the beginning, we focused on this definition difference between interpretation, writing an interp function, and translation, saying, well, I may not understand this feature, but I'll just say that it can be described in terms of this other feature. Okay? And given these ways, there was, are we interpreting or are we translating? But then there was literally how we wrote down the definition. That was, we had to use some sort of meta language. And we learned the meta language of inference rules, so we can all read lots of academic papers, as well as their very concise, elegant notation. And we also learned that we can just use another programming language. And again, I picked one that happens to be very well suited to this task. I think it's well suited to many tasks, although not all. Okay. We investigated a number of essential features, so you can slice the course up that way. You can say, well, we started with mutable variables and while loops. We then went on to first-class functions and learned that you have to think of them in terms of closures. They can refer to free variables. They're very object-like. But as we learned when we actually got to objects, objects are a little bit different because they have dynamic dispatch. There were some other features I don't have in this slide. We did continuations, we did records, we did sums, lots of really important things. And then recently we did multi-threading. We only did explicit threads. Like I mentioned, there's lots of other kinds of threads. Okay? So this was all the juicy stuff that makes programmers happy because it gives them stuff they didn't have before. And then we came along and for 30% of the class, we took away things that they already had. And we did this to protect them from themselves and to protect them from other people. And I guess I should have emphasized this more, that type systems sound terrible until you're the callee. And there's nothing better than restricting what the caller can pass you. Like, how nice would it be when writing fgetc to tell the caller you can't pass me null? And to say it in the type system rather than in the manual. Okay? But having done that restriction, we learned if you do it sort of naively, you don't get a lot of code reuse, so we spent at least half the time on types, kind of moving back from the restricted toward the not as restrictive by supporting polymorphism when we wanted to. Okay. here's some couple things we didn't do. I promised you on the first day we wouldn't do it, and I think I've stuck to it. I've tried to stay fairly scientific and not gotten into sort of discussions that I just don't think we're equipped to answer, like whether curly braces lead to more efficient programming than round parentheses. I actually don't mean to belittle that. I actually think that things like syntax and visual perception in psychology are extremely important. I lost my train of thought. I just don't know the answers. I don't think a lot of people do. And it's just not something that P505 tends to cover, that programming languages tends to cover. But that doesn't mean that this stuff isn't important. And of course, there's the real world issues like, gee, your language sounds great, but I really need a TCP interface. If you don't have one, I'm going to use another language. And that's legit. Okay. What we did focus on were concepts that almost every language has. So everything I showed you in CAML exists in many, many other languages, including languages that don't exist yet. And I think that's the most important thing. I tend to emphasize this more when I'm teaching, 19-year-olds that, really, really want to learn the current language so they can get a job. You already have a job. And we're presumably interested in learning, more about what you're already using, but also about the general principles that the next language will have too. And there's deep connections between things, like, for example, that objects and closures are fundamentally different and yet fundamentally the same. And, we do often teach a class called P501, which is more about compilers, and I've never taught P501, but if I did, I would actually do a lot of this stuff, like how do you implement garbage collectors, how do you implement closures, how do you implement objects, only I would show you the fast ways, rather than a way that's just good enough to understand what's going on. Okay? We have a final next week. I will be around between now and then, and it's only 9:12, so if people have questions, you might even stick around for a minute to hear what your classmates have to ask, and if not, we can all go home. Yes?
You make reference to first class courses. How would you define
first class? I got called on this once when I didn't have a good answer prepared. First class is a really good question. I basically mean that you can compute the answer. You can store the answer. So there tends to be basically the things you can do with values in your language, like pass them to functions, return them from functions, store them in local variables, build data structures holding them. These are things that the stuff with first class status has and the other stuff doesn't. A nice example I like to give in, say, C is that functions are first class. You can create a function pointer. You can pass it around. They're not closures. You can't refer to free variables, but they are first class. What's not first class in C or Java or C Sharp are parameter lists. There's no way to store in a variable. I like to call functions with 3, 4, and the string hello. Okay, there just isn't. Parameter lists are second class. Yeah.
Are there hardware garbage collectors?
The Lisp machine from the early 80s was a hardware garbage collector. It had microcode support for garbage collection. It had two hard drives, useful for from space and to space. Sounds really funny now. Unfortunately, this was right before generational garbage collection was invented. In practice, what you really want from hardware is some support for some of the performance critical garbage collection operations. I do not believe, and I don't think this is a controversial point, I don't think anyone these days is advocating for an instruction in your instruction set architecture called collect. But certain things would make garbage collection much faster. In particular, one of the things we really, really like to do, actually, you brought this up earlier today. We really like to make virtual memory pages read-only. That way we can tell if you wrote to them via an asynchronous signal. What's happened over the last 20 years is that has gotten brutally slow. You have to understand what slow means in this world. It hasn't gotten any slower, but everything else has gotten much, much faster. Okay, so it's relatively slower. You now take a huge performance hit for this sort of thing. And so it can now only be used for very, very unlikely situations, like someone's trying to smash the stack, whereas we'd really like to use it for only slightly unlikely situations, like someone's mutating a pointer into the nursery.
You said in C there's no way to store a variable list. What about VA list? Wouldn't that qualify as a way of storing a variable list? Because ultimately that has to be passed into...
Yeah, so VA lists are somewhat first class, but those can only... But you still can't pass them to a function that takes a dot, dot, dot. Which is, you know, I've done a lot of VA list programming. Anytime you ever write a function that takes, int x, dot, 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 I actually recommend that you immediately just call VF, some other function with x and the VA list, where you grab the VA list here. Because otherwise this just doesn't compose, right? There's no way to take one dot dot function and call another.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah, this stuff exists. But there are these parameter lists. You can't. Here's what you can't do in C. You can't say param list. Well, yeah, it is this. You can grab the VA list, but you can't call F with it. Right.
That's true.
Can you give us a quick idea of some of the interesting things that you or other people in your department are actually doing research on?
Yeah, sure. So believe it or not, I've already given a sketch of most of what I work on at various points in the course, because it's my course and I get to buy it. Let's see. I work on software transactions. My background is more on some of the safe region-based memory management stuff. So I told you about all that. What haven't I told you about? If you've been using Seminole, you've been collecting data for Ben. So Ben's trying to improve the quality of error messages from languages with type inference. So that's a big thing. And the final project I have is basically on portability. So if you're writing C code, my belief is that you probably would like it to work on several machines with several compilers, but you probably don't want it to work on every machine with every compiler. You're not trying to write totally portable code. If you're trying to do that, you'd be writing C sharp. So what I'd like to do is be able to take a large pile of C code and give you some idea of what machine assumptions you're making and where. Okay, that's work that I'm just starting, so it's pretty preliminary. The other primary programming languages professor here at UW is Craig Chambers. His background is more in object-oriented languages. He's done, I mentioned as we did multi-methods and stuff, that's a lot of his bread and butter, that's what he's very well known for. More recently, he's done a lot of very interesting stuff on compiler optimizations that are provably correct. Now, there's a key caveat there that makes this tractable. Okay? One is correct means after the optimization, your program produces the same answer. That notion of equivalent. See, we did talk about this stuff. Doesn't mean it makes your program run faster. Okay? That can be very input dependent. So an optimization might slow your program down, but it's not going to change the answer. So he's working on that primarily right now. He also has basically a framework that can basically compile many object-oriented languages down to basically something like a CLR, a common language runtime, with a common backend compiler, a lot of very general optimizations. Speaking a little further afoot from sort of stuff in this class, Larry Snyder has worked for many years on ZPL. The idea is to let scientific programmers, chemists and physicists, who know very little about programming, to be able to do reasonable large-scale scientific computation. And maybe they wouldn't get the parallel performance that a real parallel programming guru would, but it will run in parallel, and it will run on distributed clusters and shared memory machines. So imagine MATLAB that actually ran fast. Only that's a really unfair description of ZPL, but it's 9.19. Then we have David Notkin, who's really in software engineering, but he has students who do very interesting program analysis stuff that very much has a programming language flavor to it. For example, let's say you have multiple versions of your software in the repository. You'd really like to know what code from version N is related to what code in version N plus 1. And that's basically a code analysis problem. And it's very interesting for software engineering, but you need a lot of programming language techniques to pull it off. What did I forget? Oh, yeah, we'd like to work on language interoperability. We're just getting this off the ground. The idea is one way to do language interoperability is kind of the CLR approach of everybody run on this runtime. A much more interesting and I think novel idea would be a confederation of runtime systems. So generally every runtime system has what we like to call control the world syndrome. It has this like deranged view that the entire universe is controlled by it. What if you design your runtime system from the beginning without that misconception?
There's some compilers which do fancy things like changing the program at runtime to optimize for what it observes. Mm-hmm. How does that mesh with things like closures? Does it get very messy?
No, not so messy. The messy stuff is actually more at the bottom, the low level, like flushing your instruction cache and nonsense like that. I mean, fundamentally what they're doing is just taking code pointers or literally stuff in the instruction sequence and rewriting the bits to compute something else. It's messy, but it's really just low-level messy. Yeah, so another thing where this comes up all the time, so let's say you have some method in OO that is never overridden. Well, it's never overridden today. You just dynamically loaded a new class off the internet, and now it's overridden. So you need to go and undo some compiler optimization you did. So they'll go and play low-level tricks like rewriting the code to no longer do that.
It seems like once upon a time we had languages that were designed for particular problem domains. I mean, Fortran versus COBOL.
Yeah.
Most of what it sounds like people are talking about in the last 10, 20 years is putting blade guards on the saw, basically trying to keep people from cutting their fingers off with bad coding practice.
Yeah,
but you still have to have languages that allow you to get down to the bits, mm-hmm. so that you can write operating systems. I mean, is that a valid observation?
Absolutely. Domain-specific languages, things adapted to certain tasks, are alive and well. We haven't focused a lot on them here, and it kind of depends what domain you're in, what you've heard of, as well as the point that a lot of these safeguards we've put in have pushed you to a higher level of abstraction. And a lot of my research, as I mentioned briefly, is trying to say, well, now that we've learned how those safety mechanisms work in the high level, how can we move them to the low level? They won't be as convenient, but low-level programming by its very nature is harder and less convenient. So, for example, in my safe C-level language, Cyclone, I have parametric polymorphism, but you can't take a function that takes an alpha and apply it to any argument. You can apply it to any pointer argument. Now, if you're a Java programmer, this is a really annoying restriction. If you're a C programmer, this makes 100% sense. If you're a C++ programmer, you say, well, I already had templates. And I say, yeah, but it duplicates code and doesn't have parametric behavior. So, you know, there's these sort of trade-offs.
It's also worth pointing out that a lot of the techniques that we've taught in this class about interpreters and translators and really embedding some tiny language, be it IMP or STLC or whatever little language you've been talking about in another language, is how a lot of research in domain-specific languages is done. Because it's a pain in the ass to write a compiler all the way down to, you know, to the bare metal. Nope. Write it in a real easy language. You're done. You've already defined the semantics. And that's good enough for a research prototype to figure out what's going on. And so you can study all of this stuff using exactly the tools that we've taught. All
right, well, it's kind of like 9:24, so see you next Tuesday. 6:30.